creepy crawlers, spiders, lizards, snakes, dragonflies. Make them yourself with this nice plastic goop. Choose a mold, pour in the goop, eat it, and presto, change-o, you've got bugs. Squiggly, squirty bugs. They feel so soft and natural. You get four different colors of goop and special paints. Make charming lizard pins or spider rings. You can collect them or spread them around. After all, they are fun for the entire family. Get Mattel's new thing maker with creepy crawlers. You can tell it's Mattel. It's swell.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Pretty good, Mike. How's it going?
It's going good. I'm a little stuffy this morning, but I think I cleaned too many things with dust. I was straightening out the computer room because you couldn't even move in it before. Actually, it's the office, but it no longer became the office. It became more like the storage unit.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of dust.
It seemed like from your Facebook posts that you were getting into doing some cleaning or going through some storage or something like that, because you were posting stuff that it seemed like you had tucked away somewhere, like especially those Microsoft Office 3.5 floppies.
Yeah.
I remember those. I remember installing programs from a stack of floppies.
Yeah, I found all kinds of old stuff that I'm going to throw out. I really should just refurbish them, because floppies are still in demand in some areas that don't upgrade.
Oh, you mean like overseas and stuff? Or like in...
old technologies that
third world countries and stuff.
Yeah, it's like you can sell it.
I never really thought about that, how like charities might have a use for stuff like that.
Yeah.
I guess that shows me I'm living in my first world.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's some retro for you right there. You're talking about old computers.
That's right.
But
a long time ago, I bought this, the Spirit Archives. It was like electronic comics, you know, of all the Spirit comics that have been published in like 1994. And I don't know why I bought it. I just thought it was cool, like a retro thing. But there's nothing that will run it. It's like Windows 3.1. So that was crazy.
Yeah, that was another thing you posted a picture of, and it made me think about how, you know, it's for a little while there was that brief period where even, the big comic book companies were experimenting with putting out like a sort of a precursor to the digital comics we have now, and Comixology and all of that kind of stuff was to put out digital comics on a CD.
Yeah.
You know, that you could, a CD-ROM that you could buy.
Mm-hmm.
And, it would have all, like, the first 300 issues of Amazing Spider-Man or something. And they only did it with the really popular stuff, and I don't know how well they sold, but that's sort of, now looking back, is kind of a precursor to where things have gone today.
Yeah, CrossGen did something with that, too. They tried to go electronic before their downfall. And there's a lot of companies that did. I mean, Marvel put out those big CD-ROM sets, you know, where you could get like a full X-Men or full Spider-Man. So there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah, CrossGen was an interesting company, and I actually read a lot of their stuff, because when they were around was a period where I was reading pretty regularly, and I did actually for a little while have a subscription to their online. You can kind of, it's kind of like Marvel Unlimited. I mean, you could go in there and you could, and I kind of used that to catch up on a lot of stuff that I had missed.
Yeah.
Read a lot of their stuff online. But, yeah, so it's kind of neat.
I did find these binders of cards, because back in the day, I remember it was like high school and maybe some of my college years, I used to buy like a whole box of cards, like superhero cards. and then put them in. And I had like all kinds of cards, and there were some really cool cards in there. And the ones that I really found that were interesting was I found a whole deck of the Ultraverse cards. And I also found a whole deck of the Valiant cards. And I had a lot of the Chromium cards, and I was like, wow, these are awesome. And I didn't remember having them. So I found a lot of cool stuff. I don't think those retain any value, but they are very interesting.
Yeah, I wonder. I think if either of them did, it would be the Valiant ones.
Yeah, there's a lot of Valiant fans are like hardcore. I mean, yeah. they're like compulsive. I mean, I'm one of them, but I'm not to the extreme as some of them. But there are Valiant fans that feel like they have to have everything. And when I mean everything, I mean every cover, you know, every card, every art piece that was ever done, every promo poster. They're hardcore fans.
Yeah, whereas that's why I say that if either of them did have any value, it would probably be that one. Because whereas there are definitely your Ultraverse fans out there, but doesn't have the same. There aren't as many, I don't think, and doesn't have the same level of appeal. Which, you know, the Ultraverse being Malibu Comics. I guess it only lasted a few years, but it was their superhero universe. You know, their continuity as a company that started out as. Just kind of doing, you know, different titles that didn't have any interconnectivity. The Ultraverse was their superhero universe.
That did have interconnectivity.
Very, very strong continuity, yeah.
Before they did that, they had, like, the Protectors universe, which had, like, the Ferret, Man of War, and Gravestone, and those were awesome comics. It was the first bullet hole cover in Protectors. It had, a hole in the middle of it. It was interesting. But Protectors was, like, I think they were all characters, like, that were, what is the term? Open domain or whatever, where you can just write about them because nobody has the rights to them anymore.
Right, yeah. Public domain.
Public domain, yeah. So that was an interesting universe, and that got me into reading Dinosaurs for Hire, which was a comedy book with dinosaurs with guns, and I really liked it. And then they came out with Ultraverse, and I loved the Ultraverse, but I only stuck around until they got purchased by Marvel. And as soon as that merger took place. And I don't even know what the purchase is. Like, I'm hearing all kinds of weird stuff. I'd sure like to learn. Like, I wish they'd have, like, a back issue magazine that would talk about, like, some more of the independent companies. And they might have already done it, but I haven't seen it. Like, you know, the Ultraverse or the Valiant and Triumphant and all the companies that I followed, Broadway. and so I could understand, like, the how they lasted, how were they popular enough and why they went down. I think Malibu was popular, but their color process is what was really keeping them in the game. Like, they had an advanced color process that Marvel wanted, and that's why they acquired them. And then they had some kind of weird clause in their contract that if they did use Ultraverse characters, they'd have to pay the creator of, like, Sludge or Prime or whatever 5% of the profits.
Yeah.
And I think Marvel decided, well, that ain't, you know, I don't want to pay for that extra 5%. It ain't worth it. It's not that profitable to me. So that's why they went down. But I really don't know where the characters are. Like, I don't know if somebody could acquire the rights to them or still do them, but you kind of wonder if Malibu didn't sell, if we'd still see a line of those characters, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think as far as where the characters are, and I mean, it's pretty, I think that's pretty certain that, you know, Marvel owns them. But it's interesting because, you know, we had a Facebook conversation this week about this topic and if Marvel had done anything with the characters and whatnot. And Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty certain that the main interest that Marvel had in Malibu was the coloring process that they had developed. But when you look up Ultraverse on Wikipedia, there's some mention of this stuff in the history of the Ultraverse, and some of it's not cited, so its accuracy is questionable. But there is a direct quote from Joe Quesada from an interview that he did with Newsarama when he was editor in chief of Marvel, and he said, "quote It's next to impossible to go back and publish these books." And he says that there's the rumors that it's mainly to do with the sales that would have to be given to the, you know, the percentage they have to be given to the creative team. He said that while that would be a logistical nightmare to do so, quote, "it's not the reason why we have chosen not to go near these characters. There is a bigger one, but I really don't feel like it's my place to make that dirty laundry public."
Wow.
So who the hell knows what that means? I mean, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I now that you read that quote, I think I'm going to ask around to see if I could maybe get that long box graveyard guy who used to work for Malibu to tell us a little bit. Maybe he knows what some of that dirty laundry is. I don't know. But it sure would be interesting because it was a good universe. I mean, I had bought, this is other stuff that I found. I found boxes of stuff I didn't even know I had. but I think I went to a comic fest in Denver one year, and there was like a fill a box, you know, of comics and get it for $20.
Mm-hmm.
And I filled a short box, and I filled it with like a bunch of Ultraverse stuff, but not the stuff that I did know I didn't have, which was the Marvel stuff, you know, like the first year that they took over.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, this stuff looks pretty interesting. I want to explore it. And that's what led to this. And then I asked you on Facebook, which spawned a pretty awesome conversation. A bunch of people chimed in. If the Marvel website or Marvel Unlimited, you know, the digital comics had the Ultraverse, and you said no, they didn't. And that's when I went and made a I pretty much procured everything that I could find that was Ultraverse, which was like 202 comics that I didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So I have those comics coming, and they were dirt cheap, man. There was comics that I hadn't even heard of, and there, Bill from Comic Bears even said that I missed a couple that I didn't even know about. There was one called Elvin, and one that was called it was a Savage Conan magazine that had Rune in it, and I didn't order those because I wasn't aware of them. But I think I got everything else, so I'm just missing those. But that was an interesting conversation, and I hope to explore it. I buy too much stuff that I ain't gonna read, but I get this like compulsive disorder. Like when I discover, like this all started, and we're gonna talk about this, but it all started because I picked up the Rune book, and I was like, God, this is fascinating. I want to read more of it. This is volume two, and And then it spawned off that addiction that I get. And just like I go with Legion, and you know me by now, I just go off on these tangents.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. That's it drives Barb up a wall.
Since you mentioned the Longbox Graveyard, yeah, the guy's name who does that blog, which is really well done, is Paul O'Connor. And his connection, was he actually did some writing for Malibu back in the day. I think he currently works as a company who develops iOS apps, and I believe he works hand in hand with one of the main guys behind Malibu. Apologize for not remembering his name, but Paul conducted an interview with his coworker and a couple other people from Malibu for the We Talk Comics podcast, which I definitely recommend anyone. I think I may have mentioned on the show before, but if anyone's interested in Malibu's history, it's a really in-depth interview and a really good history of the background of the company and from how it got rolling through the Ultraverse and into the purchase by Marvel. But it's a good story.
Didn't talk about the dirty laundry that Joe Q was talking about, though, huh?
I don't think so. No, I don't. Because I think I would would have jogged my memory reading that quote. That's pretty interesting. Yeah, why? Because not only is the Ultraverse not available on you know Marvel Unlimited subscription service, which is basically like their Netflix instant watch of comics. I mean, you could dig around Marvel's website. There's no indication anywhere that they, you know, own Malibu or, you know, bought Malibu and own these characters or the Ultraverse in general. Cause I think, yeah, I mean, I think there's just a lot of issues, but like you said, fortunately, if you're interested in the Ultraverse, you can probably purchase most of the Ultraverse issues, dirt cheap.
Yeah.
25, 50 cents.
It's just a shame because there's so little of them. I mean, there's such great characters and there's so much that they could grow, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the flip side of that is that for the time that the Ultraverse was around, they did pump out a lot of books. I mean, if they were around now for the same duration of time, there would be a lot less.
Yeah.
You know, because this was so the Ultraverse started rolling in 93, in like summer of 93. And, you know, so that was prime like comic book boom time. So like, unlike, you know, where we've seen the return of Valiant and they've had to take a conservative approach to like rolling out their titles, and they've been smart about it because that's the reality of the comic book market nowadays. Back when Malibu started, I mean, they launched with three titles. The next month, they added two more. The month after that, they added two more. The month after that, they added two more. And they just kept rolling two more again after that. So it's like they launched summer 93 with three titles. And by the end of the year, December of 93, they were putting out like 12 or 13 titles a month, 6 months later. So...
But they were on the course to success because they launched a cartoon, which is weird for, you know, a company like that. Mm-hmm. They had the Ultraverse cartoon. They launched a toy line where they had toys. I mean, not many companies get that far.
No. No, I mean, they were definitely, you know, they were rolling pretty good for a little while there, at least, because they were... they were putting out a lot of books on a monthly basis for at least a couple years.
Yeah.
You know, unlike a lot of those companies that got started up around that time, Valiant's kind of the exception. A lot of them, you can go back, even if they're like in a situation like Malibu is, where the characters are owned by a company that's probably not going to be trading them or anything like that. Fortunately, the back issues are plentiful and cheap.
Yeah.
Because of when they were published. So
it seems like Marvel has trouble acquiring stuff and using them. Like CrossGen, they've tried to use, but they, mm-hmm. I think they went so much against the grain. I mean, with the exception of the detective story by God, I can't remember. Was it Wade? Everything they changed like dramatically. Like I don't think they needed to do it because mm-hmm. CrossGen had already established these characters and built so much around them, and then the people that would support them were like, "This isn't CrossGen,
right?
What is this?" But seems like DC, when they acquired stuff like Fawcett and and Charlton and everything like that, they've used those properties.
Well, I feel like there's a pretty big difference in the way that they go about it, you know. I think DC has always taken an approach of, like, synthesizing it into the existing universe, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, like, kind of good timing with the Fawcett characters. Like, you know, they had Crisis on Infinite Earths. And so there was a pretty good reason to have these new characters popping up. But they had them, they brought them into the main DC universe. And even just what they're doing in the New 52 with the characters from Wildstorm, they're still kind of doing it the same way, where some end up being taken on by the fans or have more fan appeal than others, but they bring them into established books and they have them interact with popular characters, you know, and then people maybe read those books for the characters they already know and then come to like these new characters from this other universe. But for some reason, Marvel's always just wanted to, with some exceptions, you know, they've, like when they didn't do anything with Malibu for whatever reason, but with CrossGen, it's not like they took these characters and brought them into existing Marvel books or the Marvel Universe. They just published them as these offshoots, like its own separate thing. And like you said, it was, there was no hook for someone who hadn't read any CrossGen, and then the people who did know CrossGen were turned off by the fact that it wasn't similar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the one you mentioned, I think that was called Ruse.
Yeah.
That probably was the most similar, and because the other ones that they did, were, you know, they only took like a basic concept from it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who's gonna buy that, you know?
Yeah. And it's also, like you said, it's not ingrained in anything. They're keeping it separate.
Right. So. Whereas what DC's done with some characters, they've incorporated to some extent that several decades later, you know, the casual comic book fan probably doesn't even know that they weren't originally a DC character. Like, you know, Captain Marvel and the Marvel family. I mean,
yeah.
If you're not like a big, huge comic person, you're not into comic book history, you might not even know that that wasn't originally a DC character, you know?
And that was a long lawsuit.
Yeah.
It's kind of a dirty one, too, I think. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have worked today.
Yeah.
They took away a property because it was similar, but there was enough difference there. In my eyes, yeah, the guy could fly and he was strong,
mm-hmm.
but you know he had all the gods, you know, the gods providing powers, and he was a little boy. So
yeah. I mean, DC's claim was that he was similar to Superman, which
yeah.
nowadays that wouldn't have flown, no pun intended. But it's like back then, you know. I guess you could get away with some things you can't today, because there's been other characters more recently, you know, that more like Superman than Captain Marvel is. You know, it's just that was their way of trying to deal with a competitor, and it worked, you know.
Yeah.
Dirty pool.
All right, so this is Geek Brunch Retrocast number 20, yes. And I am Mike. 20.
And I am Chris, and this is Keith Knutson's sound conditioner to help him go to sleep. This is the only podcast with built-in rumble strips.
Yeah.
As a new feature today, between our segments, I'm just going to go
and wake him up. Yeah.
So that Keith doesn't crash his car.
He was milking goats yesterday. I don't know what he was doing. He didn't record with us.
Yeah, I saw that, and I saw that he must have fixed his Untappd app link to the Twitter, because he was spamming Twitter, man.
Oh yeah, I can't believe how much he puts in his system at one time. He's like, he acquires like 6 badges in one night. I mean, how do you do that? How does body endure that?
I've never got drawn in by the badges. I'm on there and I get badges randomly. I don't even, you know, it's always a surprise to me because I'm not really paying attention. But I think he was proud of me last night because I got a badge last night. And he gave me the thumbs up.
He's proud of it. Because it's a video game to him. It's like, go to the next level. I need to drink some more.
Like Xbox achievements.
Yeah. He'll even drink shit he doesn't like. You know, to hit the next patch.
Yeah, I'm not that dedicated.
Why are you drinking Bud Light? I mean, I know you don't like Bud Light. Why are you drinking it? Oh, because I want a light patch.
Yeah. Yeah, he's checked into some kind of Miller Lite or something like that last night. Like, what the hell? I'm not toasting that check-in.
Yeah. I don't know, man. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. But, well, what should we start with today?
Well, why don't we jump into the Ultraverse since I'm already there?
Yeah, and I think last time we did start with Kirby. And in case I forget, once we, you know, later on, we do have a question that came in last time after we got done recording.
Let's do that now.
You want to just do that now? Okay. So this was actually came in after we recorded last time, and it was from Ken Jr. And he asked what our favorite non-Joker Batman villain was. And then would we have picked the Joker if we were allowed? If that makes sense. The way I read it.
Yeah, I'd pick the Joker if I was allowed.
Yeah, me too. It's hard to beat the Joker.
I think my favorite villain, and she sometimes falls into like, is she a villain? Is she a hero? Is she shades of gray? Is Catwoman? Mm-hmm. I absolutely love to read Catwoman. She's probably one of the most successful in her own title, like Batman villains that's ever existed. Like, she's always had, I mean, as long as I can remember, in the 80s, she's had that Jim Ballant series, and then it morphed into other series. It's already had like three incarnations and a mini. Mm-hmm. She's even had Elseworld titles, and I love Catwoman, and I think it's because she's got so many shades of gray. Like, she's a thief, and she steals stuff, but that sometimes she does heroic stuff. And she's a villain and then she teams up with a lot of my other favorites, like Harlequin and Poison Ivy. I love those three together. Like, when they did Gotham City Sirens, mm-hmm. I was in heaven, man. Not only did it have March's art, which is one of my favorite artists, mm-hmm. but it was just an amazing book. Harley's close up there, though, man. She's amazing. You know, a character created for animation that's probably one of the most popular characters in terms of cosplay and recognition in video games and stuff that's out there. She's a really marketable character.
Yeah, and probably the most successful character that's come into the comics from an outside medium.
Yeah, her and Renee Montoya.
Yeah. But, and what do you think is the reason for Catwoman's popularity and success? I mean, do you think it's because she's sort of an anti-hero, you know, that she's like, it gives writers more to do with her, that she's not just straight up like crazy?
I think she's has sex appeal. I think she's an anti-hero. I think her relationship with Bruce is so ingrained and out there mm-hmm. that it intrigues people.
Yeah.
And it's got like a tightly romantic and questionable relationship that's always there in the background, both in the New 52 and Old 52. And because in the New 52, they got it on, man. They were rocking, you know. It was sexy time.
Yeah, they stripped any ambiguity from that situation.
Yeah. So I don't know. And then plus she's a strong woman. She really is. Like, mm-hmm. she's not going to take shit from any man, that's for sure. And she's had like run-ins with Two-Face, and she could hold her own against these crazy, crazy fuckers. And she's sane. You know what I mean? I think she's got a OCD thing, you know? Mm-hmm. Even when she tries to do good, she always has that thing like, I want to lift this thing or steal it, you know, in the back of her mind. So she's got a compulsive disorder. She just got so many dimensions to her and so many things that creators can play with.
Yeah.
That, you know, even when she went up against Black Mask and they tortured her sister and stuff, I mean, she's just a fascinating character. And a strong woman. Like I said, she ain't going to take shit from the Commissioner, Batman, any of the little sidekicks.
She does make an interesting counterpart to Batman because she's similarly not superpowered. You know, so there's the same in that, but they're opposite, obviously, in gender and in, you know, their moral compass is different enough that they can't really ever come to terms with each other, but that they're constantly sort of circling around each other in a way that's unique. Not, you know, it's not the same as the way that he and the Joker interact. Or,
and he recognizes her skills. Like, he's used her for stealing things and also being like the mole, you know what I mean, in the Justice League. Batman's done that before.
Yeah.
He's brought her into the Justice League pre-52, and she's in the Justice League. She was in the Justice League of America post-50, you know, new 52.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's out there.
Yeah, I think because when I mean, I always recognize that she's can be considered a villain of his. But because one of my favorite comic book runs is her, I guess it would be her second solo series. But yeah, the run that Ed Brubaker had as writer of her, and she was, that was probably one of the times that she was closer to being a hero. I mean, most of the thievery that she did and stuff like that was shown to be done to benefit the community, the part of Gotham that she lived, which was fairly poor. You know, and she supported a lot of like the downtrodden and like, you know, people in her community. So she was pretty much a hero at that point. So that's so imprinted in my mind that I tend to always think of her that way.
Yeah.
But,
that was a good series. That was really good.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
many dimensions to that.
Yeah, very, very good. Like, very good run. Definitely recommend it if you haven't read it. I mean, I wasn't really much of a Catwoman. Like, the character didn't have a draw for me on her own, but I had known Ed Brubaker and read stuff by him and checked it out for that reason. And he made me like the character a lot more, but it's also just really good comic book writing. I mean, the way that the series is structured, I think he was on it for like 30 something issues or something like that, but character storylines build on each other. When you think that's just like a six stories issue storyline, ends up playing into later storylines. Just very well written comic books. But and the arts, I mean, if you are a fan of like Cameron Stewart style art, you know, he was the one who did some of the early issues. It's really great.
Kind of like an animated series look to it.
Yeah, yeah. I love the art too, so that's part of it. But yeah, so I mean, and I always think of Harley Quinn too. I mean, she's so similar to the Joker, though. I mean, if I kind of have to step out away from her as well, I think I would probably say Poison Ivy.
Yeah, I do like her. She's up there for me.
Yeah, I can't resist the redhead.
She's definitely like super sexy. I mean, like, plus she's so ingrained in loving nature and, you know, right, plant life. And it's almost like if people embrace plant life, she's not your enemy. You know what I mean? It's just that she has such a hatred towards people because they don't think twice about cutting down a tree or, you know what I mean, killing a plant.
Right. And I think that's one of the things I always enjoy about stories that she's involved in, is that I find it interesting when the villain's cause is not evil, like when the villain is not necessarily after their own personal gain, or they're not just batshit crazy, that they actually have a cause that's a valid cause, but they're just messed up enough that they're going too far, or the means that they're justifying are going too far, you know. So I always find it interesting with her because it adds a little layer of complexity.
Yeah.
Like Batman's stopping her from the methods that she's using, even if he doesn't necessarily disagree with her goals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how she goes about it.
She also has Shades of Grey too. Another mm-hmm. character that has done heroic stuff in the past.
But and if I allow myself one honorable mention beyond that, I would say Mr. Freeze, mostly because of like you know, the origins, like as such a tragic character, he's one character that was really touched by the Batman the Animated Series. One of the best episodes of that series is this, you know, the origin. I think it's called like Heart of Ice or something like that.
Yeah.
Where his origin story was told and kind of redeveloped. And also, I mean, with Scott Snyder has kind of done a take on that in the New 52, changed some things up, but also is interestingly tragic. So, good question.
Yeah, the other thing I want to point out about, I thought you were going to say Arnold Schwarzenegger is what drove you to Mr.
Yeah. I can see how you might think that.
But I just want to point out that on the Catwoman thing, she's probably the most recognizable supervillain in comics, I would say. And the reason is because she's been around forever. Like, we had Yvonne Craig and Julie Newmar playing her in the old Adam West series. And I think there was a couple other Catwomen. But those women are gorgeous. I mean, I think they're amazing.
You had Michelle Pfeiffer. That movie was huge.
Yeah, and she also spawned her own money with her own movie, which was a flop, which was Halle Berry.
Right.
So they could have gone a different way with that, and it might have had some success.
No, I mean, it was a flop, but it was a very well-known flop. I mean, people out there know who Catwoman is for sure.
Yeah.
More than just the average comic fan. And
let's not forget she was in the new trilogy as well. I forget the actress's name, but she was big in the last movie.
So. Yeah, I can't believe I'm drawing a blank right now because I really like her, but...
Yeah, I've seen her in
what
another.
What the hell is wrong with us?
Addicted.
We're gonna get fired from podcasting about comics.
What's the title of the movie? Batman Begins. No, that's not it.
Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises, and that's why it's not doesn't have Batman in the title.
At least I remembered that. Thank God. It was. Anne Hathaway.
There you go, Anne Hathaway.
Dun, 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 dun.
So, yeah, there's... And then you talk about the characters that you mentioned. They've all made appearances in the animated series. They're popular. They've been in the movies. Poison Ivy and Mr. Freeze were in the same movie.
Yeah. Yeah, technically.
Uma Thurman, Arnold Schwarzenegger. That was when the franchise I think went off the rails, but
yeah,
I'll still watch it to this day.
Another thing with Catwoman, you reminded me, was just that she's been around almost as long as the Joker as well. Her history goes way back to the Golden Age. I mean, it's a very different take on the character, and whereas the Joker's been a little more similar in his history, but she goes way back as well.
Yeah, and I have her first appearance. She actually had a physical cat head, you know.
Yeah.
First appeared in the Golden Age, so
yeah.
And just to comb it, her first series was in 1989 by Mindy Newell and J.J. Birch. It was a 4-issue miniseries. It had some of her abusive stuff in there, And then in 1993 to 2001, that was a long run, man. It was pretty much a bunch of writers like Doug Monk, Mary Jo Duffy, Chuck Dixon, Devin Grayson, Ostrander. And the majority of art was done by Jim Ballant. Like, you talk about a consistent run on a book. He, like, lasted, like, 70 issues.
But yeah, you mentioned those different writers. And I didn't even really know that they were the writers. I mean, the main thing that I think that that series is identified with is with Jim Ballant's art.
Yeah. And that went 94 issues, had four annuals and a 1,000 or 1 million issue. And then the third series was the one I believe you referred to with Ed Brubaker and Darwin Cook.
Right.
And Brad Radner and Cameron Sturt as artists. And mm-hmm. that ran from 2002 to 2008. That was an awesome series. And then we have the current incarnation, which is the new 52 Catwoman. And
yeah,
we've had Gilliam March and doing art. He at least kicked it off with Judd Winnick. And then you had Anna Senti, who I really didn't like initially, but it's kind of grown her. She's got like a wacky storytelling style, but it grew on me because it's so bizarre. Like, it's just, I don't know what she's thinking, and it's just weird, and I like it. And it took at least 6 issues or 7 issues before it grew on me. I wasn't liking it, but I kept getting it. So yeah, she's had quite the run. And many different costume changes. We could talk about that for hours, but
yeah. Well, and briefly about that. I mean, 2002, the beginning of that series was the debut of the costume that she has in the new 52 still. The black costume with the zipper and the down the front and the goggles. Because prior to that, with the Jim Ballant series, you know, she had the purple cat outfit that was just kind of like a unitard.
Yeah. And the dress. She's had the dress outfits.
Yeah. That was earlier on. But yeah, her costumes changed a lot over the years.
Yeah. The cat face.
yeah.
But
whereas, you know, I mean, Batman, you can look at his costume over the years, like, and there are differences, but there's subtle differences. She's definitely had more radical changes to her costume. Yeah. Just keeping the cat theme.
Poison Ivy has changed a lot too. In the new 52, she's got more clothes than she's ever had, but usually she's just covered with plants.
Yeah.
And then the classic one, I have her first appearance too, believe it or not. I went on a kick of at least Silver Age first appearances.
Mm-hmm.
And I have like Penguin, Catwoman, Riddler, Scarecrow. I'm so glad I went on that tangent, because back when I did, they were a lot more affordable.
Yeah. Silver Age is not cheap anymore.
Yeah.
For sure.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I can make a whole episode out of that question.
yeah. I mean, so I thought we'd get that in. Since it didn't get lost in between episodes there. But so you said that you've been digging into some Ultraverse then that you wanted to talk about, right?
Yes. I'll start with the one that was kind of mediocre. Like I liked it, but it was very hard to grasp it, being at an issue number one. And I think the reason is because it started with issue Infinity and then came to one. And one, even though it says all new number one, only $1.50. This was Mantra number one. It's when it was relaunched. The creative team was Dave Roberts, who I've never heard of before. And he is the artist. Who's the writer? Wow, it doesn't even have the writer. How does it not have the writer in the credits?
Maybe they wanted their name taken off.
This is bizarre. I had to take a picture of it. It doesn't credit the writer. maybe it's the same guy. Maybe it meant to be art and story by Dave Roberts.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, it's got to be, because that's who they credit on the cover. But this is Mantra in the original was a dude that became a woman, and it had this like weird, awkward situations, and she was a mystical being. And later on, she had a baby, and then the babysitter got involved, the blonde girl, and now she's Mantra. And it seems like every time that she becomes Mantra, the other girl that was Mantra, you know, with the black hair, she goes mm-hmm. into this mystical zone where she can't do anything. And this story opens up with a guy that's very much like he's like a little dude. He's like a small person, like Dr. Psycho in Wonder Woman. He even kind of looks like her. Mm-hmm. And, except this guy is obsessed with video games. So he's got like this little Game Boy controller, and he's like bringing Mantra into the Game Boy and trying to take her out. And she eventually gets away from him. And the other Mantra is trying to escape from like this zone. And it just gets weird. It's craziness, because she escapes, and then she starts following this magical trail to try to find where the source of magic is coming from. And then she ends up in I guess there was a boyfriend at the time, or a guy she liked, and he took pictures of her like when she was at the beach and was posting them on like sites and sharing them with his friends while she was in her bikini and such. And so she decides to phase through the room. And she doesn't know her powers at this time. Like, she doesn't know how to use them. But when she phases through, her clothes don't phase through with her. So she comes into the room, and there's two dudes in the room, and they're both looking at pictures of her, and she shows up naked. And then so she flies out. She's like, oh, my God, they see me naked again. They'd probably think I'm such a pervert. And she flies out of there naked and grabs her clothes again. And then and then there's like this the coven. There's a coven of Mantra fans, and they're like four girls in high school that get together that try to summon up witchcraft and all this stuff to try to be like Mantra, and mm-hmm. they actually make themselves a demon that's called the Coven. Wow. It's like a merger of all three of them, and on like the shoulder pads is a head of each girl. And on the right between the boobies is another head, and then the face is another head. So all four of them have a head on this creature. And the first place she goes to ravage is the shopping mall, because they're teenagers and Mantra has to fight them. So it was a real interesting. And then the daughter goes to the next door lady and says, I need help. My mama's trapped and all this stuff. And she's trying to get help from this older woman. And then the Dr. Psycho dude, the video game dude, comes in, and it's to be continued.
You know, for some reason, female superheroes have the worst luck with clothing.
Yeah. And then there was some interesting story letters in the back about, it was written in by a girl. This was the only letter that I thought was interesting, but a girl wrote in, and she was like ranting on, why is Mantra considered a bad girl? You know how the 90s had the bad girl theme?
Yeah.
And she said, there's nothing bad about her. Can you explain to me what bad girl means? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Why is she a bad girl? Like, she's like, I could see Necromantra being a bad girl, but Mantra's not a bad girl. This is an interesting letter.
Did they give her a response at all, or they just published it?
No, he just said it's like a label, like when you go to a grocery store and it's like an incorrect label, like groceries are labeled correctly, but you can't label, you know, comic book characters like that.
Mm.
But it is an interesting story. I have the next issue next to my reading pile, and I was going to read that one before I jumped into something else.
Yeah, you know, it's... sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's interesting that, you know, because I've only read like the first few issues of the original Mantra, and like the whole shtick was that it was like a guy in a woman's body, so there was a lot of attention given to, you know, he was kind of a man discovering what it's like to be objectified and stuff like that. Like, it was like there was definitely some like gender stuff being explored there. So it's interesting that, at least from the way I'm understanding it, that they like sort of removed that aspect of it entirely, right? Because the new mantra is originally a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she's so, like the she was like the babysitter, and I don't remember. I probably don't even have the issues, and that's why I don't remember. But I have them on the way. Why? How she be? How this girl became the, you know, mantra. I didn't read those issues. So now I can read them and find out how she became him, and how where the other Eve where she's at.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah. We got a little hiccup there. Skype hiccup.
Oh. I was just saying that I don't know if I read those issues.
Yeah, and I was saying, I think, if I remember correctly, I think it wasn't just that, you know, Mantra was a guy that just turned into a female version of himself or like a random... It was actually like an emerging, so that he was inside of the body of a woman that had like a, you know, a woman, a real woman that had existed prior. I don't know how to, I'm phrasing that awkwardly, but so he had to kind of take over her life, and like she had kids and stuff like that. So it was, so maybe it was, yeah, the babysitter of her children or something. Cause I kind of remember there being a character, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Regardless, it's interesting that they took out that sort of fundamental aspect of the character.
Yeah, but the character's still there, so I don't know what the relationship is or if they could. There was also another interesting letter in there that talked about the merger. This is when Marvel merged. They had that Black September event, and they kind of like mentioned, I hope you don't do what the other company did, like DC with Crisis on Infinite Earths. It's like, it was an interesting thing. Man, this is weird how the credits don't have the writer, but I did find who the writer was. Even in the back, it's got credits, you know, like it normally does on the title page.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the back, in the letters page, it also does all the credits, tells you who the cover artist is and everything. No writer. But I found out who the writer is Mike W. Barr.
Oh.
It's not credited in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not a no name for sure.
Right.
Hmm. Weird.
So what do you got?
Well, I was digging around Marvel Unlimited, and I guess you had affected me with all of the werewolf talk recently. Because I ended up pulling up and digging into some Bronze Age horror stuff myself, and I read some Dracula. So starting out with what I found out was kind of jumping in to the middle of a story somewhat, but you know, comics around this time, it was pretty easy to do that with, so... Because I started out, I read Giant Size Chillers, number one. And, so this is basically Tomb of Dracula, but it was... And it basically, the way it reads, it kind of functions as an annual would nowadays. You know, after reading it, doing some research, I found out that they did three of these at the same time, or around the same time. There was this book, which had Dracula in it. There was Giant-Sized Creatures, which had Man-Wolf. And then there was Giant-Sized Monsters, which had, not Man-Wolf, Werewolf by Night, and Giant-Sized Monsters, who had Man-Thing in it. But this story is called Night of the She-Demon. It was by written by Marv Wolfman, art by Gene Colan, who... you know, I'm familiar with as a team on, what's it called?
Tomb of Dracula?
Well, yeah, they work on Tomb of Dracula, but with the Night Force.
Oh, yeah.
So they would do Night Force together for DC, but, you know, this story takes place where Dracula has returned to London, and he's got a you know, as Dracula can put hypnotize humans and use them as slaves. Basically, he's got a guy named Quincy who works in Parliament, and his name's Lord Henry. So Lord Henry works in Parliament, and Dracula uses him to establish a new residence Lord Henry has prepared for him, and also to gain diplomatic immunity. So we switch from that to a scene between this young couple, Angel O'Hara and Ted Hannigan, and they're at Angel's father's house, and Angel's father has just found out that she's pregnant with Ted's child, and that they had married in secret, and he's not taking it well. He's smacking his daughter around to her husband's protests, and calling her like a bunch of derogatory terms, and Ted tries to stop him, and Mr. O'Hara gives Ted a huge right hook, and Ted bangs his head against the wall and is killed accidentally. So meanwhile, we get these scenes of a spirit rising from a grave, and the spirit nearby floats in, and as Angel is grieving that her father just killed her husband, father of her unborn child, the spirit possesses her and turns out to be Lilith, the she-demon of the title of the issue. She's the daughter of Dracula. And I found out that this is actually the first her first appearance. I found out later on. But basically Lilith takes possession of Angel's body, and her appearance changes to that of Lilith. She takes out Angel's father, feeds on him, and then goes out to find the this guy named Quincy Harker, who apparently had killed her 30 years ago. And she shows up at Quincy's house, and it seems like him and some of his followers, like they're vampire hunters, and it seems like they had previous appearances in Tomb of Dracula. Like around this time, Tomb of Dracula was in around like issue 21, 22. So there's definitely some continuity that carries over from the main series. So Lilith shows up, and she seems to be able to switch back to Angel's regular appearance and pretends to be in distress to gain access to Quincy's house. And she feeds on him and seems to have killed him. So, but later on, some cops show up at Quincy's place and find him and discover that he's still breathing, take him to the hospital. Meanwhile, Dracula heads to the castle that his slave, Lord Henry, procured for him, and it turns out to be habited by this woman named Sheila Whittier. And Sheila, we don't really know what the deal is, but she seems to be trapped in this castle. She wakes up, puts on her nightgown, and she's got these lashes all over her back, like she's been whipped. And when she hears Dracula, she expects him to be her tormentor, whoever's been doing this to her. He tells her that that's not the case, and that, he's conscious to, we realize that he's conscious to attack her because he's looking for, a new servant, basically one that will be more reliable, or will be that he will have to place under less control than Lord Henry. So so he's interested in taking control of his castle, but first he has to kind of figure out what's going on with this girl Sheila, and you know why, who is attacking her, and what's going on with this this castle, which is called Castle Dunwick. But Dracula's presence has drawn Lilith, his daughter, and interestingly, like, you know, so he spots her as a bat and recognizes that it's a vampire bat, and so he changes to a bat himself and flies up and sees her, and they end up having this long conversation at a rugby game of all places, which I thought was kind of funny. But we get Lilith's origin here. And, you know, Dracula's not happy to see her. He basically, you know, immediately speaks to her in anger and seems to hate his daughter, and has hated her for hundreds of years. So we find out that, you know, Dracula was, before he became a vampire, he was married to this woman that he didn't want to be married to. It was like an arranged marriage. And he really loved someone else. So he hated his wife because he was stuck with her. And he had a baby with her, and ended up kicking his wife and the baby out into the streets. And so his wife, in distress, gave his daughter to gypsies and then killed herself. So... meanwhile, you know, Dracula has turned, you know, he's turned into a vampire and goes on a killing spree, killing all these gypsies. And as a payback, one of the gypsy that has his daughter, knowing that it's his daughter, curses her, so that she'll be a vampire as well, but won't be vulnerable to crucifixes or sunlight or anything like that, and that her life is forever connected to Dracula's. If she's ever killed, eventually she'll resurrect, as long as Dracula is still alive, and that she'll always like haunt his existence.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting connection. So she wasn't made a vampire by him. She's made a vampire separately. And he pretty much hates her guts and hated her mother's guts and pretty much an asshole about it.
but it's usually the opposite. Usually you kill them and they turn back to normal, but you're saying if they killed her, she couldn't die, right?
Yeah, she's basically immortal as long as... She was killed, and it turns out that that's why, you know, she resurrected from her grave, was that it's just this periodic resurrection. As long as Dracula's still alive, she's meant to haunt his existence. So...
I don't think I've ever seen that play on a vampire before.
Yeah, and they, I mean, they have this conversation that the history is recounted, you know, her origin is recounted, and then they, it seems as though that this has been going on for a long time, though, and that they've reconciled to some extent, whereas they, like, leave each other alone somewhat, but, so, it's weird how, you know, this issue establishes a couple of storylines, like this issue with Lilith and then the issue with Castle Dunwick, and neither of them are really resolved here. At this point, the Lilith storyline kind of drops off. We get a caption that she leaves and heads toward America. And then we have a little bit more of the Castle Dunwick storyline where Dracula goes back there. And as he's arriving, Sheila, the woman trapped there, is running from, you know, her tormentor spirits or something like that. And Dracula, so she's sort of pushed by an unseen force off of the second story landing, and she's falling to her death, but that's when Dracula shows up and catches her and saves her, basically. And, you know, he thinks to himself, lest we think that he's, through and through hero, that, you know, he wants the castle for himself, and he wants Sheila as his servant, so he's going to search out, you know, who's ever responsible. And he thinks that he senses an actual human, not a supernatural force. And it turns out to be Lord Henry, his prior servant from Parliament. He'd broken the spell that Dracula had over him and had actually set up this whole situation as a trap for Dracula, hoping to lure him to this castle and attack him. And he, you know, he lunges out of the darkness with a stake, but he misses Dracula's heart, fails to kill him. So as just sort of a last desperate act, Lord Henry shoots himself to death just to deprive Dracula of his service. So they end the issue kind of thinking that, you know, Sheila is grateful to Dracula for saving him, and Dracula, you know, wants to use her gratitude as so that he can have a servant during the day that isn't just, you know, mind controlled by him. And it's left to think that, you know, that the reason, you know, the whole thing behind Castle Dunwich was just Lord Henry. But, you know, I was kind of curious as to, you know, but you know, there's some captions basically to the effect that you realize that that there's something more going on with the castle, but there's nothing further in the issue. And things end with just a two-page letter basically from Marv Wolfman discussing, you know, the history of Dracula at Marvel Comics and how they've strove to establish a continuity in the books and, you know, have ongoing characters and not just, you know, not just have these one and done horror stories. And then, you know, he promotes the other giant size issues that are coming out. But, so yeah, I was kind of interested at that point because I enjoyed the issue just to do a little bit of like research to sort of figure out, what was happening after this issue ended, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of weird that they did that. It's so tight, you know, like with the regular series. Why didn't they just have that story in the regular series? Because they put this original material out, and then they have two reprints in that book.
Right, yeah. And on Marvel Unlimited, the only thing that's on there is this story. Like, the other two reprint stories aren't, at least they might be where they were originally appeared, but they don't appear in the file that comes up when you click on Giant Size Chillers number 1.
Yeah, it's like, which, like Black Vampire reprinted from Mystic number 25 and Village Graveyard reprinted from Weird Worlds number 4.
Yeah, so, yeah, and this came out in, at least it's dated June of 1974 to give you some context. But yeah, if you don't have Marvel Unlimited, but you're not into reading comics digitally, you can also find this in Tomb of Dracula Volume 2, if you want it in color. That's still in print. That came out a few years ago. There's 3 Tomb of Dracula trade paperbacks that are in color. There's also the Essential Tomb of Dracula, which has several volumes, which would be the black and white reprints. But
is it in the omnibus as well?
And there were some omnibuy as well. It looks like those are out of print at the moment. If you don't already have them, it might be a little expensive.
I have Volume 1 and Volume 2, but I don't have Volume 3.
Yeah, so this was, like I said, this falls around Tomb of Dracula 22 or 23, so that's around where it would sit, because like I said, in the paperbacks, this is this would sit sort of at the end of Volume 2, along with, yeah, so when this came out, Tomb of Dracula had a storyline that was wrapping up in Tomb of Dracula 21 and 22, that didn't have to do with this, so the story of the Castle Dunwich is actually continued in Tomb of Dracula 23. Like, it picks up literally right at the moment that they're standing there with Lord Henry's dead body lying on the floor, having shot himself.
Did you read 23 or just researched it?
I did read it. I don't know if I should go right into it. I know that was.
Oh, is that going to be your second one?
Yeah. I mean, I could talk about it. You can do something.
You got me hungry to read this now. I don't know. Damn it. Now you're like I'm doing like the Homer Simpson thing. You're gonna vector me away from the Ultraverse to go read Tomb of Dracula now.
Yeah, I can always save the.
It's like donuts.
I can leave it as a cliffhanger there. I can let you read on your own to find out what's happened with Castle Dunwich.
Yeah.
But you know what? I was interested. Like, okay, where the hell did the story continue? And then, so I saw that, you know, from the recap on comicbookdb.com that the story clearly continued in issue 23. And it also said, you know, I looked at the page there for Lilith. That's how I discovered that it was her. Because when you're reading Giant Size Chillers, it doesn't necessarily seem like it's her first appearance. Like, because they do establish her in a way that there's a history there. So you could, what you read as her origin could have been a recap of something that came before, because they were pretty good at doing this. Like for example, I mean, when you pick up Tomb of Dracula 23, you could just pick that up and not have read Giant Size Chillers, because like the first two pages recap enough for you to get into the story. And I saw that in addition to the story in 23 clearly being about Castle Dunwich, there was also listed as an appearance of Lilith. Well, it turns out that Lilith's appearance is just in one panel where during the recap where Dracula's remembering what had happened in Giant Size Chillers. As far as I can tell by just like flipping through her appearances, she makes some others appearances, but they seem like also cameo appearances, and it doesn't seem like her stories really continued until around Tomb of Dracula 60-something, like 3 years later.
Wow.
For whatever reason, it seems like there's a storyline where Dracula finally goes to America and tracks her down in New York. So it looks like that storyline was continued, but it, you know, for whatever reason, took a while.
Does it have the full Tomb of Dracula comics in the Unlimited?
Let me see where it actually ends, but I was flipping through to look for issue 23 and there was quite a few on there, which so I can investigate while do you want me to save Tomb of Dracula 23?
Yeah, I'll talk Rune, and then we'll go back to Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, so the next one I read was Room, Hearts of Darkness. This was by Doug Monk and Kyle Holtz. And I love Holtz's art. Like, he did a lot of Batman covers in the 90s, I believe, and then he's done The Goon. Not The Goon, but the... trying to think of the series. Billy the Kid and the Oddities, which is written by Eric Powell. And I just love his art. It's a real dark and creepy art. And if you remember his Batman, he had like really big horns, kind of like Kelly Jones, like Holtz does. And his art looks a lot like Kelly Jones, actually. It's very similar. And This story is kind of like an origin story. At least that's what it appears to me. And I only have one number one from September 1996. It even has the video game in there of Super Nintendo Capcom, Marvel versus Capcom. That's interesting. So this story opens up like a comet that lands on Earth. And this thing has like life. And as soon as... like the primitive natives and the cavemen go visit it, their souls are sucked up into it, and the asteroid or it's like a cocoon grows bigger and bigger and bigger, and it pretty much takes out whole communities because it takes their souls, and then they end up killing each other, and it goes through many centuries of killing various people, and finally once there's this barbarian that actually goes up to the asteroid or cocoon. and he's able to like steal some of the energy from it, and he becomes like Rune, which he's like a vampire with wings, and he's got like, it's weird, he's got like these infinity gems hanging from his neck, like these crystals. And once he gets, then it cuts to New York in current time, and he's there, and I don't remember what his purpose is there, but he hooks up with this really sexy girl and then decides to take her life, and he's like biting people left and right. He's kind of like this is actually like a villain's month. He's like a villain that has no remorse, or, you know, he'll kill whoever he needs to kill. And then it's got a side story where once he stole stuff from the cocoon itself is its own entity, and it steals souls from other people to go try to capture Rune and bring back the source of power back to the cocoon that which he stole it from. And it was really a good story, and this is what sucked me in. And then in the back, I guess they had a wizard create a villain contest for Rune in Wizard magazine. And the second story was like, I don't even know, it was like James Felder and Pandora Brothers. But I don't know if whoever won the contest created a weird looking character to fight Rune. And it was, I forget what his name is, Akkar the Scarred God. And he looks like half demon, half human, and so whoever won that wizard contest got to create a character that showed up in the Rune comic in Rune number one. And then since I'm talking Rune, I didn't have any other Rune Hearts of Darkness, so I read Rune number one, which was volume two, which was also very close to the time that Mantra came out. You know, it says all new number one, still only $1.50. And this series is all over the place, and it kind of ties into a lot of the stuff you're talking about with, like, the Infinity Gauntlet and stuff. It's crazy, oh, yeah. Man. It's just crazy shit, because I guess at this time, some of the Marvel Universes characters were showing up in the Ultraverse, and Warlock was one of them, and this series is just off-the-hook weird. I mean, it's so bizarre, and I can't really explain it, but I absolutely love it. It's just very weird, but there's this character who you think is Rune, but he looks like Rune, but it's like a split personality. There's two entities in it. One's kind of good, and one's kind of bad. And when the bad personality takes over, he's a vampire. And he's like a superhero, but he kills only bad. Like, he wants to kill everybody. He wants to rip the necks off, drink blood. He doesn't care who it is. But the good angel side says, no, you're only supposed to kill people that are bad. And so Rune is like, he'll only kill, like, they're mugging a girl and going to rape her. And they end up killing all the, you know, the bad guys. And the girl goes away, but he has this, like, thing where he wants to feed on the girl, but he doesn't let her, the second entity. And then later on, the second entity takes over the body, and he's like this golden-looking god, kind of like the Silver Surfer. And he's like the extreme opposite. He wants to do total good. There's these terrorists in the building, and they're going to blow up the building. So he, like, ports in there, and then he, like, saves all the people in the building and kills all the bad guys. And the girl that he saves, he ends up in his apartment, and she's like, you creepy naked dude, why are you keeping me here? And you're a terrorist, and I can't believe what you did to all those, you know, terrorists. You killed them, you know. And she wants to report him. And it goes from one extreme to the other. And then you have a weird storyline where Adam Warlock is in space in a cocoon, and he kind of like hatches, you know, he gets resurrected every now and then. And then it goes into, like, the different phases, and it mentions Infinity Gauntlet, and now he's on this Earth, and he's going to New York to meet up with Rune. And we never see what happens, because then I read the next three issues, and the cops get there when Rune takes over again, and he kills the girl that he saved, the other entity saved. Because it's like split personalities. So this golden being saved this girl, but then he turns to Rune like at night And then he just drinks her blood, and the police get there, and they're, like, shooting at him. And then there's this whole helicopter scene, and then there's another Ultra that's a police officer. Like, there's this – the pilot's saying, I hate Ultras. I want to kill them all, kind of like the hate of mutants. I hate Ultras. Mm-hmm. I want to kill them all. Let's kill them. And then she's like, not all Ultras are bad. And she turns into this, like, creature with wings and goes and fights Rune for a while, and then he drinks her blood. And then the story doesn't even continue. Then it goes into 4 and 5, and then all of a sudden, damn, Rune is in the negative zone with Annihilus. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? It's like the real Rune, you know, not the ones, the Rune split personality and the golden superhero guy. They're like different from Rune, and Rune's really in the negative zone. And then he's flashing back to a time where the plague was going on in medieval times. And then he fights like this guy called the Crusader, and it goes into like he would always like when the plague would hit a certain area, he would just destroy it. And the Crusader eventually went and tried to kill him. The Crusader's a good entity that tried to kill Rune and thought he did, and Rune comes back and fights the Crusader and kills the Crusader. And then I guess they're gonna go back into the plot of what's going on, but this was Len Kaminsky and Kyle Holtz, and then the art team changed, and it's Kaminsky and Ellis, and then Kaminsky and Rollo. It's like the art team is changing every issue.
Mm-hmm.
And But it's very consistent look and feel. I'll give them that credit.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like when DC's been doing it, you know, on Wonder Woman and stuff. It looks fairly similar.
Yeah.
But it is just out there. I've never seen so many plot twists and changes, and I really don't know what's going on. And I should like to talk to the guy and say, explain to me how could he exist in the negative zone and then half of him is out at night on Earth? You know, I don't understand. And why does Annihilus have him imprisoned there? It's like I missed the last few issues of volume 1 of Rune and I don't know what's going on. You know, that's kind of like Mantra. It's almost like the series should have never renumbered. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a good jumping on point.
Yeah. I'm looking at Mike's World of Comics right now, and it looks like, you know, when Marvel, so the stuff that you read was a brief attempt at Marvel relaunching the Ultraverse, still with Malibu Comics on the cover, and that was the last time they really tried to do anything, and it only lasted like a year at most. You know, that Rune, there was 7 issues of that. I think there was 7 issues of Mantra, but then later that same year, after the 7 issues of Rune, they did the 3-issue Hearts of Darkness. So it actually came after. There was a Rune Silver Surfer team up, and there was a Rune versus Venom issue.
Yeah, I actually ordered those.
Those ones are actually
not cheap. Ones that have like Rune and Conan and Rune and Venom, they were like at least $6-7. They were not like, you know, $1 or 80 cents or whatever they were.
The print run on those is probably a lot smaller, I'd imagine, maybe.
Yeah, plus they feature big characters on the cover.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's probably more demand.
Mm-hmm.
But Hearts of Darkness, it did read like a number one. This read like it was continuing on from another story, and I missed all the story, and it didn't give me the backstory. Like, I'm just reading along trying to figure out what that backstory is. And I'm on issue number 5, and issue 4 and 5 just vectored so far away from what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here's flashbacks of Rune. Rune's stuck in the negative zone. He's having a flashback of medieval times. And it like left the story just hanging, and I'm like dying to know. I'm so confused. I'm dying to know what happens. And you know what's really good about these issues is there's just enough on the last 2 pages to like hook you. You know, as a monthly, like I want to know what happens. I want to know what happens. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're addictive.
Yeah, I wonder how rune number 7 ends.
Yeah, I want to read it.
But yeah, it looks like, so the original series ended rune number 9 in April of 95, and then Rune Infinity came out in September 1995, and naturally that never ended because it's Infinity.
So Infinity came out...
Sorry, that was terrible. But yeah, Rune...
Well, Infinity was the first...
Yeah, it came out September 95, so after like... So that's what, like 5 months in between, and then Rune number 1 came out right after that.
That is weird. That is all over the place.
But it's good that you didn't get stuck reading Rune Infinity for the rest of your life.
That's a lot of reading.
Yeah, the never-ending comic book.
I hope they don't leave me on a cliffhanger in number 7.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. Well, so it didn't seem like Hearts of Darkness number 1 was continuing for anything, because that came out 5 months after Rune number 7.
Hearts of Darkness, to me, seems like a modern take on a new origin of Rune.
So it's more like an Elseworlds or something?
I don't know. I can't explain it.
Yeah.
Maybe my database has something. What does it say? Yeah, it's like an origin story. And it's like an origin story, and now... He's in New York City in current time, and that's where this story leads. And it also says it's a flip book in each issue with art by the Panda Brothers. Panda Brothers, and that's that wizard contest thing. So, yeah, I don't know, man. It's bizarre, and that's only 3 issues, so.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to completing that one, because that's what sucked me in. That one had some story flow that made sense to me. It was pretty damn interesting. And this other one's just so interesting because of the bipolar personality, you know, the schizo personality of the character. It's like sometimes he's good, sometimes he's bad, and when he's bad, he still has the good voice like Firestorm saying, "Hey, don't do this." And then when he's good, he has the bad saying, "You should rip this guy's throat out," you know? So it's just bizarre. It's crazy time.
Yeah, it sounds like Marvel kind of did do what I said earlier they didn't do, is that they did put initially the Malibu characters, you know, they did connect them with Marvel characters, established Marvel characters. Maybe they just didn't sell well. Or maybe, you know, whatever this dirty laundry came about or started rearing its ugly head. Who knows? But, interesting. Well, with Tomb of Dracula 23, like I said, we pick up right where we left off at the end of...
Did you just... Wait, before you get to it, did you just use Google to find out where the story continued, or did it tell you at the end of that story continued in Tomb of number 23?
No, so what I did was I went into comicbookdb.com. And I looked up, Giant Size Chillers, number 1. And then I, from that, I linked over to, the timeline of Marvel's Dracula characters' appearances. And then, you know, so I looked around when, Giant Size Chillers came out. The next issue of Tomb of Dracula was 21, and 22, I could tell, like, there's like was a little plot synopsis on there, so I could tell that it had nothing to do with what was going on in Giant Size Chillers. So when I clicked on Tomb of Dracula 23, I could tell from the plot description that that's where the story picked up. So it's like they had to finish up the story, this other story that was going on, before they picked up the end of Giant Size Chillers. So it's kind of weird how it was. But I think it sounds like Giant Size Chillers was meant to be on the newsstand for several months, instead of just for a month. I think they, because of the larger size, they, you know, they had like a longer sell date. So yeah, that's how I figured it out. But and yeah, it does pretty much pick up right where the where Giant Size Kid Chillers left off. And we get a couple pages of recap after we just revisit, you know, Dracula and Sheila standing there with Lord Henry having shot himself. And all of a sudden there's just this loud laughter from everywhere around them. And it's pretty clear immediately that Lord Henry is not the main source of whoever has been tormenting Sheila in the house. And we and Dracula still really don't know the story of what's the deal with Sheila and why she's in this house and why she doesn't just leave. And so we finally get that backstory, which is pretty, like, pretty messed up. So the house is called the Dunwich Castle, and it's named after her uncle, Sheila's uncle, Alistair Dunwich. She'd never met him prior to coming to the castle. He supposedly died, and she received a notice that she was to go to the reading of his will. So there were some other relatives of his there that he left things to. And to her, he left this castle. And it's pretty creepy because the letter, you know, in the will, he wrote that he had never, though he had never met her, his niece, he had seen photographs of her. And so he left her this castle, and he said, quote, "May you find it as irresistible as I find you." So a little creepy there, creepy uncle. She's kind of reluctant to even check this out, but her boyfriend is pretty curious, and he convinces her to go check out this castle that she's inherited.
She doesn't want to go?
She's a little reluctant, which, considering the lecherous nature of the message from her uncle, like, I guess I can...
Very sexual.
I can see that, yeah. It's kind of creepy. So, but they do go, and they get there, and it's, you know, it's a pretty creepy place. And she's, you know, her reluctance continues. Her boyfriend's pretty curious about the place, and he wants to explore. And as they are going down to check out the cellar, they open the cellar door, and a force sort of pushes her boyfriend down the stairs, and he, like, smashes his skull open on the cellar floor and dies.
Wow.
So
I bet he regrets saying, "Let's go."
Yeah.
Check out the place. This is going to be awesome.
Yeah, that might have been going through his head as he flew down the stairs. But so presumably at this point is when she's sort of trapped there. I mean, we kind of we jump ahead in time, and you know, when Dracula is, you know, Dracula again, lest we think that he's just a hero, it's once again reiterated that he plans on, you know, using, he almost seems to be, like, wrestling with himself, like he you know, mentally sort of reassures himself that he's not, you know, he's not saving Sheila because he cares about her, he's just saving her because he wants to use her as a servant. So he heads out, having, like, heard some of the backstory. He heads out to find someone he can feed on. And he comes across this woman. And Wolfman, you know, as was the style at the time, he does use a lot of captions. And in this case, it's pretty effective because he gives us some backstory about this woman, Carolyn, that's driving down the road, so that she's just not a random victim. We know that she has a family that she's heading back to. She has two little kids and a husband, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Dracula at this point, you know, he still is a monster. So he causes her car to crash and feeds on her. It's kind of crazy. Like, Wolfman gives us her fate. So Drax actually turns her, and you know, just in this little caption, he lets us know that Carolyn returned home, turned her entire family into vampires. Her husband, Randolph, killed 2 years later by Blade. Her children, so she and her son later died from, like, lack of ability to find blood to feed on. And then her little daughter, Emily, lived for 150 years before she was killed. So we had an entire history of her family in this little caption box, which I thought was kind of awesome in a way. But back to Dunwich Castle, Alistair Dunwich appears. He's gotten strength as his spirit is actually the one that's lingering in the castle, and he's become strong enough as a spirit that he's actually able to manifest his, like, old appearances in ectoplasm. And he reveals that the story is even more screwed up than we might suspect. As he speaks to his niece, it turns out that he's actually not only her uncle, he's actually her father. So the original,
that's even more creepy.
Yeah, yeah. So at one point he was living at this castle, and he met a woman, and this woman killed him. For the castle. So he cursed her on his death and made a pact with the devil that he would come back to life as a different person. And so he came back to this castle and to the woman that killed him and became her lover. And he impregnated her. And that was... So that was her mother. So that was, what's her face? Why am I drawing a blank here? Carolyn? Sheila. Sheila's mother. So that was Sheila's mother, and he is her father. And then he proceeded to drive Sheila's mother insane, and to the point that Sheila's mother eventually killed herself. So now, to pay back the Dark Lords, as he refers to them, he must sacrifice Sheila as payment for allowing him to come back to life and get revenge against the woman who killed him. So he takes Sheila and throws her into this room in the castle that we haven't seen before, which he refers to as the Church of the Damned. And in the Church of the Damned are skeletons that begin moving around that are chained up that are previous sacrifices of his. And also in the Church of the Damned is his original body, which has been turned to gold. So at that point, Dracula shows up and, recognizing... So we basically have, like, Dracula mixed up in a haunted house story, which is kind of cool, a combination of genre, horror tropes. So Dracula recognizes that the statue of gold, this Alistair's former body in gold, is actually, Dracula knowing how some of these things work with being, like, connected to being a demon of sorts of himself and being connected to hell himself. Knows that if he smashes the gold statue, that's what's tethering Alistair's spirit to the real world. So that's what he does. And as Alistair's ectoplasmic form is melting, he laments the fact that Dracula would destroy someone that's also a servant of the same Dark Lords. And Dracula has a pretty cool parting line where he says, "I am a greater hell than any you could ever imagine." And that sort of wraps up the story of Castle Dunwich.
How do you spell Dunwich? Is it Dunwick or?
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to title this The Ruins of Dunwich Castle.
Nice. So that's a pretty, I find that Wolfman, so far, the stuff that I've read that of horror, you know. He does a pretty good job with it. Comes up with some pretty creepy scenarios, and I like this little story. So it seems at this point, you know, Dracula is able to use Sheila as a servant and use Castle Benwick as the base, and whatnot. But yeah, I read this. I found that there was no real continuation of the Lula storyline, and that it seems that that really wasn't picked up again till later on. And you had asked earlier how much of Tomb of Dracula is on Marvel Unlimited. It looks like it goes up to so it's, they do have from issue 1 on through issue 53. But Tomb of Dracula actually continued to issue 70. So it looks like, at least right now, if I want to continue that Lilith storyline, I'll have to pick up those issues. Because they don't have the last, like 54th or 70 at this moment. But yeah, it ended in 1979. Dracula, you know, did make some appearances later on here and there, the Marvel version of Dracula, that is.
Does Marvel Unlimited have something like Netflix that says, like, new to Marvel Unlimited this month, and then it shows you a handful of books you could read, or...
Yep. I think they're actually added on a weekly basis. You can look, like, there's, like, a release calendar that you can click on. And then click on new in a Marvel Unlimited. And it shows the stuff that's been just added. So they add a mixture of new and old stuff. And they've gotten into a pretty good, consistent schedule of really, of adding what I, you know, refer to as new stuff, meaning, they're on kind of like a 6 month, old schedule. So they just this week added like Guardians of the Galaxy number 1, Uncanny X-Force number 3, Young Avengers number 3, Uncanny Avengers number 5, etc.
Do they remove stuff like Netflix?
Not really. I mean, I think if they do remove something, it's because they have to for some sort of like rights reason or legal reason. But for the most part, no.
Okay.
It doesn't seem like they really release stuff. And so then, in addition to that, they also continue to fill in holes in the back issues. So
you might show that they might show up eventually.
Yeah, it's possible. Although, you know, it looks like...
I wonder if they have like a helpline where you could say, please, when are there any plans to do Tomb of Dracula to finish it?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it looks like, you know, they're adding some amazing Spider-Man issues that they don't have in there. Like, they added 367 last week and or a week ago and whatnot. So...
Do you have any others? Any other books you want to talk about?
Well, I did. I read some more Camelot 3000.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll go through those quickly.
Okay.
Since you know, I read issues 3 and 4, and there's still, you know, it's a 12 issue miniseries, so. I could pick up, you know, I can put some more detail into later issues. 3 pretty much deals with, like, so last time we talked about how Lancelot and Guinevere, you know, had, you know, were reawoken, that they were living as modern people in this future, but their souls were reactivated upon seeing, you know, Merlin and King Arthur. So issue 3 kind of continues that process while dealing with some subplots, like the knights that exist so far head out individually, and Arthur finds and awakens the soul of his foster brother Kay and Guinevere. It's kind of interesting, like I'd mentioned last time, that there are these beings called Neomen, which are it's like a form of a penal colony where they take criminals and stuff and they turn them into these mindless zombies. Well, as Guinevere is showing up, Percival, the knight Percival, is about to be turned into one of these Neomen, and she awakens his soul a moment before he's turned, so he's still actually turned into a Neoman. But she's still brought back because he, even though he can't communicate, his ability to communicate or think clearly has been disrupted by being turned into a Neoman, his soul is still in there. And we also get Lancelot reawakens the soul of Galahad, who is in a Japanese, like a sort of a futuristic Japanese samurai who is just about to commit seppuku or ritualistic suicide because he allowed his employer to be killed. So Galahad's actually Lancelot's son, so he convinces him to continue to not kill himself and to join their quest. And finally, Merlin heads to, there's actually two. So Merlin reawakens the soul of Percival, I believe it is, in a man living with his family in Johannesburg, South Africa. And then the boy who had awakened King Arthur originally, he's still helping out. He goes and shows up at a wedding where two people are about to be married, because that's what happens at weddings, Chris. He assumes that it's the man, but it actually turns out to be the woman whose soul is reawakened. And she leaves. She turns out to be Sir Tristan, and insists on being called Sir Tristan, even though like everyone is a little bit weirded out by the fact that Sir Tristan is now female. And her husband is pretty pissed off about the whole thing and actually like punches the kid in the face and vows to follow them.
Keith's favorite name, Tristan, from Legends of the Fall.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Well, this is like, hopefully Michelle doesn't hear that. It's like, Tristan in a female body.
Yeah. Tristan is his Han Solo.
He's a married man.
He's a married man.
But this is like his dream woman. A woman named Tristan, and she uses a crossbow. I'm surprised he made it through reading this.
I think that character is more interesting than Brad Pitt was in any day in that movie. I didn't like it.
Yeah, no. So in issue 4, we find out that the UN is pretty corrupt. So on top of the fact that they're not doing a very good job of dealing with the alien threat, the UN itself is not excited about the return of King Arthur. That has gotten the people excited. They're more concerned with dealing with any like threat to their power than they are of really dealing with the aliens that are invading. And furthermore, the head of the UN, a man named Jordan Matthew, plans to further to betray the members of the UN to try to consolidate power himself. So there's a lot of scheming going on here, while the newly recovered members of the Knights of the Round Table are outfitted with their gear, and just kind of like we get some pages of just them kind of coming together as a team. while the UN, just as the UN decides to, you know, to attack their new base, which is you know, the new Camelot, which is the satellite that was owned by the man that Lancelot was before his soul was reawoken. So we get, you know, a lot of issue four is a battle between these UN soldiers attacking New Camelot, and we have a couple cameos again. Furthermore, like as issue two ended, appearances by Morgan Le Fay, who we find out has working with the head of the UN, you know, and planning some downfall. So it looks like we're going to get in the next issue five, we're going to get some background as to how, you know, Morgan Le Fay is still around as well. Because, you know, we know how Arthur Merlin and the Knights have come back into this future world. But other than knowing that Morgan Le Fay is still around, we don't know how she has come to still be around. So it looks like we're going to get that explained to us. But if I have one small complaint about, you know, so I'm really enjoying the story. It's fun. It's this high concept of, you know, the Knights of the Round Table in the year 3000 works way better than you think it might. I was just a little annoyed when I came to a really cool splash page in issue 4 when the newly assembled Knights of the Round Table are rushing out to meet the attack. There's this really cool double page splash, but the way that this paperback is bound kind of ruins it, because Arthur's at the center and he's basically like trapped in the gutter. He's trapped by the way that it's bound, so that you only see like the sides of his body. So that kind of sucks.
Yeah.
It doesn't come into effect because like where normally that's white space, you know, on most of the pages, but you know, it screws up the double page splash, unfortunately. A small complaint. I mean, it just would otherwise be a really cool page, and you can still see everybody else, but he's in the center, so he's smushed in, like you folded him in half. But it's really cool how the character designs are really neat. I will say, just how, you know, like Tristan, you know, she's got like a sort of a black leather outfit on with like a red bandana around her neck, and she's got both a sword and a gun strapped to her back and a pistol and a bandolier around her chest. And they're all kind of like, they're different outfits. They're all kind of a combination, a really neat, like effective combination of futuristic and medieval. And they all have swords, but the swords have like futuristic properties. So they use like a combination of weaponry. Really pretty neat. I mean, I'm surprised at how well this concept was pulled off so far by these creators. So
yeah,
it's the new trade paperback, so it's very readily available.
Yeah, they have hardcover for that too.
Yeah,
like a deluxe oversize.
So that's it for that. I'll keep reading that, though. It's pretty good stuff.
All right. Can we take like a 2-minute break so I could take a pause for the cause?
Sure.
I've been drinking a lot of water, right?
I'll take advantage of that, too. some coffee going through my system.
All right.
All right. See you in a couple minutes.
All right. We're back on.
We're back. Bladder's emptied.
Yeah, I want to mention something real quick. I got a Kickstarter in the mail, which is kind of like a retro flashback, but it's modern. It had mini comics. It was a mini comic that Seeley did with a couple other people. And it came with like 6 mini comics. And I got a art sketch, which was awesome. I got an Elastigirl.
That was awesome, yeah.
Yeah,
I saw that and I was like, damn, I should have supported that Kickstarter and got a sketch.
Yeah, I like that when they do that and it's affordable, like like a con rate, because you get I got the comics, the digital comics, plus I got a sketch out of it. So
yeah,
I like when I when the value matches what you're getting, you know?
Yeah, that's what it's all about. For me, when I mean, I've heard some people have problems with Kickstarters, you know. All the ones I've supported have gone well.
Yeah, I was wondering about this one because it was a long, long time ago. I didn't even remember who I asked for in the sketch. But it came and I was really happy with it. I also got the this is kind of retro too. I got like some Kirby prints, like because I supported the Kirby. You know, they did a picture book for Kirby, the son, or no, the grandson. There was some prints that they put out. There were 3 prints, and I got those in the mail before the book, but that's they were pretty awesome.
Yeah, nice.
It has Starman Zero, and it's kind of like he designed this character and then had all these... He, like, points out that he's got, like, magnetic soles on the boot, a catcher's mask, a portable atomic motor on his back. It's pretty crazy. And then it has, like, Jack Kirby's Gods, and it has, like, something that looks very similar to Celestial over, you know, in space with a lot of Kirby crackle. And then the third one was, like, it looked like a page in a comic, but I don't know if it ever saw print. But it was pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah, I like that about... A lot of times when, at least later on, when Jack Kirby would do character sketches, he would have little notes on them that told you about their design, you know, their costume or their powers and stuff, and it's always really cool. Like, the little notes that he puts on there.
Yeah.
Just shows how he was thinking it through and his design and stuff. I have kind of a funny story that has nothing to do with anything. So, the other night, you know, Kara and I were both reading in bed, and she, she was turned her light off and was going to go to sleep. And so I asked, you know, I'm just going to read another, 10 minutes or so, if that's cool. And she's like, yeah, it's fine. And so then, you know, she woke up later on, and the light was still on, and I was sleeping with, my book on my chest, you know?
Yeah.
And so she tried to wake me up, and I was dead to the world. I told her I didn't respond. And she fell back to sleep with, you know, the light still on. And then she woke up again later on, and the light was still on. So that time she shoved me really hard to wake me up.
Uh-huh.
And finally woke me up, was able to wake me up. And and I said, I don't remember any of this, by the way. So I said, what? And she said, turn your light off. And so she said, I reached over, and I turned the light on and off 10 times.
Man, what were you drinking that night?
I don't know. But I guess I finally turned it off. And the only reason I knew any of this is I asked her in the morning, because when I woke up, I woke up and I was sleeping on top of my book and my phone and my glasses.
Oh, man.
So I was like, I mean, they're really old glasses. They're really old prescriptions, so it's not that big a deal. And they were fine because they're really sturdy. But so I was like, did I turn the light off by myself last night? And so then she told me that whole story, but I thought it was kind of funny because I didn't remember any of it. And I was like wondering if I was.
What were you reading? What were you reading? What was the book on your chest?
It was a book. So it was a paperback, called Return of the Crimson Guard.
Ah, it's a
like
Star Wars
stuff. No, it's like a fantasy. So there's like this really long fantasy series called the Malazan Book of the Fallen, and I've been reading it, or I've been making my way through it for over 2 years now. I mean, it's a really long series, but I've also been reading it really slowly because I have all these interruptions where I'll just read comics and I won't be reading the book and stuff, and this particular volume is taking me a really long time to get through. But I recently resumed my efforts, and I'm trying to read it before bed all the time. And if you like fantasy novels and you feel like, and you've read Game of Thrones and you feel like there aren't enough characters and the plot line isn't complex enough, check out Malazan Book of the Fallen. It's insane. I've had to go back.
You
and
too
like,
won't be able to turn the light off. It's that good.
I mean, it really is good. It's just so long. It's over 10 books, and some of the books are super, super long, just in individual volumes. And I mean, I don't know when I'm ever going to finish it, but the fact that I haven't give up on it is probably a good, says something good about it. But I've had to go back. I've had to go onto the internet and look on like a wiki page to remind myself of who certain characters are at times.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy, but yeah. So I don't know if I am like a dick when you wake me up at night or something, or I was just messing with her, or why, or because I really wasn't.
How many badges did you achieve that night?
I only had 2 beers.
Yeah, Keith Knudsen levels.
they were like, I had 2 beers, but they were strong. They were like
18%.
Yeah, not bad, that bad, but I think they were Miller Lights, so let's say that.
Yeah.
So that was pretty funny.
All right, you want to jump into Mr. Miracle number 12?
Yep.
I love this issue. This is my favorite. I mean, I liked them all, but this was my favorite because I found it funny.
Yeah, and as a reminder, this is... So the other Fourth World series have ended at this point, so we have 3 issues of Mr. Miracle.
In the cover, it's got him attached to a torpedo, and they're launching him at a mine. And it says he's speeding, he only has seconds left, and the villain is Mistivac.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting villain, because once you learn what it is, it's pretty inventive. You know, for this time, everything he does is pretty original. Like, I don't know of any other comic book like this where it's about an escape artist that does things for entertainment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's not out there to, like, save the day. I mean, sometimes he coincidentally ends up doing that, but
yeah,
it seems like his primary objective is to tour and set up these traps and perform them on TV now,
mm-hmm.
and film them and then show them to everybody. It's very unique.
Yeah, and Kirby's content to make up all his own shit. Like, I mean, he used Superman and Jimmy Olsen because he had to, but other than that, I mean, he just makes his own characters.
Yeah, he makes up his own shit.
Yeah.
And this one is really interesting, and I don't know how they convince the military to do it, but they decide to strap him to a torpedo on a ship. It looks like a submarine, like some advanced type of submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And they shoot him out, and it's not like underwater shoot, it's like airborne shoot, and then the torpedo goes under.
Yeah.
Oberon and the general are inside of a helicopter watching it witness as he's fired towards a landmine. And it hits the landmine, and just like always, Oberon's like, I can't look. This is terrible. He's dead. I don't
see
nothing.
The general is like, I don't know why I approved this.
Yeah, it's like, how did he approve that? That's like, torpedoes cost a lot of money. It's like government funding, and we're just going to allow it for entertainment. But they shoot it into there, and then you see Mr. Miracle waving, and then they pull him up. And they're like, hang on, we hate to see you fall in again if you survive that blast. And then there's this guy, Colonel Darby, he's a weird character. And he's got like his own Alfred. And they're kind of like looking on. They witnessed it. And they're like, this guy's amazing. He's going to make me lots of money. And the way they want to make a lot of money is to show this and then bet against Mr. Miracle.
And yeah, they're like British gentry, like they're like British upper class.
Yeah, gentlemen. Can you do a voice for them? Do you know how to do British?
He says, "An incredible performance, Colonel Darby. Remarkable, sir. How did you discover him?" The chap's got a promoter. Get him a line or two in the press. I've been following his career.
He's got a monocle.
That was very good. I never met an accent I won't try to screw up terribly.
And Mistovac is kind of like a robot, you learn, and he's kind of like driving the car that they're taking off, and he just accepts commands from Colonel Darby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got this whole production going on now that the original Mr. Miracle's son is Mr. Miracle's press agent, and you know, it's just a lot of publicity stuff going on. They're back after things are going on in front of the press, and just doing the promotion thing. When all of a sudden, a reporter comes flying in the middle of a shot and lets all the other reporters know that there's the real action's down on the beach. That there's some girls that are mopping up the Navy and fighting the sailors. So they go to check that out.
I love the scene with the guy running and his pants are falling down. It's so great.
Yeah, as they're making their way down there to find out what's going on, yeah, a soldier comes flying past them. I mean, there's sailors just flying through the air above their heads. They're having to duck to get out of the way of these sailors that are coming, shooting off the beach, getting thrown by whatever. And other reporters arrive in front of a fence to start filming and taking photographs just in time for the fence to get exploded by another guy that comes flying in. And sure enough, as you might suspect if you've been listening or reading along, it is Sparta and the female Furies that are responsible for the ruckus.
And they're in bikinis enjoying the beach.
Yeah. Except for, Stampa and the Saad sister, what's her name? They have the bikini bottoms.
I don't know, but she looks ugly. They have the bikini bottoms. She's horrible looking, the Saad's sister.
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely the Saad is one of the last men I would see and wonder if he had a hot sister.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like Stampa because basically she has her normal outfit on. She's just replaced her pants with bikini bottoms, but otherwise she has her long sleeve orange shirt on and her helmet and her glasses and all of that. It's pretty funny. Unless Sheena still has her like weird helmet going on.
Yeah.
I love that scene with the sailor, though,
when he's running by and the guy's like, what's going on down there? It was this dame. They call us Sheena, sir. She went at me with a lash and pow, she whipped all the buttons off.
Yeah, when the general and Mr. Miracle get up there, Big Barda's just standing there. She's got a soldier. She's holding She is holding a sailor in each fist, you know, lifting them up by the off the ground by the back of their uniforms.
Yeah.
Like it's no thing. Like she's holding a couple sandwiches.
And her name is Bernadeth.
Right. Yeah. There you go. If I would have just looked down the page.
Yeah.
This is Mr. Miracle tells the general who they all are. So it's, that was a pretty awesome appearance.
Lashina looks pretty good in a bikini. But meanwhile, you have this Colonel Darby, and he's setting up the bet, and he's going to call Mr. Miracle, and he calls him, and I guess his thing, his shtick is he can convince people to do certain things, and he's like, you want to die, Scot-Free, you want to die, do not turn death away. And he likes on the other end listening to the phone, and he's like in a trance, and he receives that message. So the next thing they're doing is they're going to launch this huge boulder onto Scot-Free, and he has to escape after all the Furies. Stampa launches the boulder from like a teeter-totter in the air, and Bernadeth takes her dimension blade, splits the boulder into threes, and then Lashina splashes it all into, or she lashes at it, and it turns it into one device to go hit Scot in the face, and he doesn't get out of the way. And I guess they're filming this, and they're witnessing it, so Colonel Darby can make money, but little does Colonel Darby know that Big Barda loves Scot-Free. Well, she's starting to show love for Scot-Free, and she jumps in the way and stops it because she realizes he's not quite himself. Mm-hmm. And she breaks the boulder up into several chunks, and Scott's okay, and he doesn't realize what he had just done, really.
Yeah. Yeah, they're kind of, they've incorporated the Furies into the act, and they're, you know, putting on a show here with all of them involved at this point, now that they're part of the whole same troupe and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, so we get, like you said, Mr. Vac has those mind control powers, so he uses those also
Ted.
The original Ted. Yeah, Ted. Ted's the promoter of Mr. Miracle, so that he won't give a warning to Mr. Miracle when ahead of time when he heads with Barda and Oberon to this mystic temple where Mr. Vac is waiting for them. And he pretty much takes out uses his powers to take Barda and Oberon out of the fight so that he can have a one-on-one with Mr. Miracle. And they fight as these superheroes are wont to do. But yeah, Mr. Vet keeps showing up like different powers. Like he has his fist is able to extend. He's got like Wolverine claws that make a snick noise when they come out. It's almost close to the same effect. And he's continually reinforcing Mr. Miracle's desire to die, you know, with his powers. And Mr. Miracle's having to struggle mentally against the influence. But, we think all along that, you know, Mr. Vac's some sort of a robot or something. You know, and they're going back and forth, and they're fighting and stuff. And finally, Mr. Vac gets trapped in a pit, and he's not able to get free. You know, but he still has the power of his voice. But Mr. Miracle walks up and removes what turns out to be a mask, a helmet of sorts. And it turns out, surprisingly, that Mr. Vac isn't actually a robot at all. But he's like, he's like a little miniature alien. And I think it looks like, I mean, his whole body is like contained within the head, right? He's like,
yeah,
this little green seat. He's got like a green wrinkly head. And he's inside, like almost looks like he's got his own little mini flying saucer that sits on the neck of the robot. And he's a hater. He hates
humankind. And he thinks that Colonel Darby has been manipulating him, but he has no choice but to obey him. But his servant guy shoots a bullet at Mr. Miracle, and he dodges it, and then hits the glass container that Mr. Vac is in, and he can't breathe in our atmosphere, so he pretty much turns to dust. He disintegrates.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, Darby tries to escape and Barda goes after him, but he slips by, but Oberon luckily sticks his foot out and trips him. And then they turn him over to the police, and then Ted is there and says, hey, you know, let's not collect the winnings on this act. It ended rather sadly, I'd say.
He's like, well, that was kind of sad. Let's, let's let them keep their money.
Yeah.
Mr. Miracle and Barda are pretty cool with it. They're just like, all right.
I don't care. Let's go.
The show must go on. Let's go. Yeah, it's actually kind of sad. A little bit of a downer ending.
Yeah, with a lot of humor in that one. I liked it.
Yeah.
And then that leads us into Mr. Miracle number 13, which was, it says Dictator's Dungeon. And then it's got like a train running, trying to go over Mr. Miracle. And they say, stop it, he's committing suicide. So yeah, he's in another trap where a train is going to hit him. And he has to get out in time. And again, Baron's freaking out. I think Barda doesn't really care. The one time she interrupted, she was right.
Yeah.
But he always seems to escape, and he does escape that death trap.
One thing I like about the death traps is Kirby always draws Mr. Miracle's bindings. Like, there's no possible way anybody could get out of that. It's not like he has a couple of chains across him. I mean, he's got a neck collar, and there's like usually like three or four bands going across his legs, and his fists are wrapped up in metal, and there's just like there's chains and binds, and everywhere you look, I mean, it's just like there's just no possible way anyone could get out of that.
Yeah.
And so it's always very elaborate. But what's kind of interesting is that this Mr. Miracle now has a subtitle, Super Escape Artist, and it starts appearing as like as part of the title from this point on. Just a little minor note
here. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah. Now that it's the only, you know, remaining fourth world title, I guess. But yeah, as you said, I mean, this issue starts the way most of them have started, with a trap set up, and but then this like bizarre sort of helicopter shows up and draws Ted up into it, and there's some sort of weird folk piloting with that are wearing like Devo hats. but it's called the Magnalift, apparently. And Mr. Miracle and Big Barda take advantage of its magnetic attraction by allowing themselves to be attracted to the bottom of the ship so that they can come along and rescue Ted. And sure enough, once it's like elevated a bit, Barda just punches her fist right through the bottom of the hull and they climb up through. you know, and a battle ensues with the characters that have abducted Ted, and
they're Aborigines, weren't they?
Yeah, they certainly look like that. They look like
I think even called them out as Aborigines.
Okay, yeah, they look like sort of ape men, but they have like futuristic costumes on, and have, you know, futuristic weapons, but they don't have too tough of a time taking them out, and so then are able to take over the ship, but they're not able to really change the ship's course. It's being controlled by remote. They suspect Darkseid, but no matter what they do, they can't really change its course. And once they get over top of this sort of snowy mountain area where there's a temple, a trap door opens up in the ship, and Barda and Mr. Miracle fall out, leaving Ted still on the ship.
And his anti-gravity boots save him, and he catches Barda. And Barda, it's the first time I've seen her in civilian clothes. She looks like she's wearing a regular dress and outfit for the time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, she's either been like in her warrior costume or just like her like casual clothes, which were just her casual clothes tend to just be it's kind of a neat touch because like I don't think she even really cares about clothes when she first shows up on Earth, or really like sees the need to not just, when she's not in battle, walk around in just like a couple strips of fabric. And but at this point, maybe she's been on Earth for long enough that she's starting to wear some normal clothing for women on Earth.
And that leads them into this structure where this guy is commanding he's actually captured Ted Brown, and he's got like this weird, it looks like a, I don't know, like a Chinese helmet, a type gold helmet that he wears. And he's captured Ted, and he's going to tell him why he's captured him, and he's going to try to get rid of Mr. Miracle and Big Barda. And Barda and Mr. Miracle come across this, what would you say, entry to a dungeon or something, like a tunnel, and it's heavily, has this heavy armored door on it, and Barda just rips it off, and they enter into the tunnel. And as soon as they do that, they're getting shot at by the Aborigines that were there with their, and then you get like swastikas, and then that's where it got really weird, and you're like, what the hell's going on? Well, turns out this guy was a Nazi scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is his name? I can't find his name.
Well, they initially, his servants call him King Komodo.
King Komodo.
Yeah.
And then they later on tell him who he is, because he was working for the Fuhrer, and I guess he witnessed, it actually says Der Fuhrer. Do you notice that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, there's this statue, that's it's Dafura, like Dafura, and it's like, it's dressed up in like oriental like flourishings of like what they call an oriental temple. I know that term's not become sort of out of fashion, but as Ted recognizes, it's in the Heil Hitler pose. So it's like, it could be, it's a statue of Hitler that's been covered up and modified.
That's when you realize, I think I know why I was kidnapped. And Mr. Miracle says, don't jump to conclusions. Let's find entry into this cell. And the times that I do see Mr. Miracle take out, you know, being taken out or something, it's usually because there's some kind of knockout gas or something. Mm-hmm. And it knocks both Barda and Mr. Miracle. Mr. Miracle gave his cape to Barda to keep her warm, by the way.
So oh,
she's
right, yeah.
She's wearing his cape. And is this where we learn his name? Albert von Killowitz. Killowitz.
Yeah,
he's a Nazi war criminal.
That's who Ted believes he is, yeah.
Yeah.
For real. But yeah, they're trapped in a situation where they're in this room where there's a monitor that Killowitz can speak with them. But acid starts raining down from the building. So, you know, Mr. Miracle's suit protects him from that, but and his cape is made of the same material, so they're actually able to, you know, spread the cape out over top of them, so that all three of them are protected from the acid. So, you know, his Komodo or Killowitz, whatever you want to call him, his servants are pretty much ready to, like, you know, write the obituary, but Killowitz knows that Miracle's got enough talent to escape the trap. He doesn't seem real shocked that they had survived, but he basically tells him, you know, if you want to escape, you know, you have to play this game with me. You got to make your way through a series of traps. And, you know, if you actually make it through all the traps, like, I'll let you go. And Ted warns Mr. Miracle to the effect that, you know, there's no way he's actually going to follow through with that promise, because we know who he really is, and we can, you know, reveal that this Nazi war criminal is hiding here. So he's not going to let us go. But Mr. Miracle says, you know, we don't really have much of a choice. So, you know, we might as well move forward.
And he starts walking down this huge barrel, and you're like, what trap is this? And it's like a barrel of a huge cannon. And they're shooting the missile out of the cannon and trying to destroy him. But Mr. Miracle has those boot jets or boot lasers and shoots his way out of the cannon before the gun was fired. And he uses those he's got those fingertip flames or things that he can use to carve his way back into the palace. And immediately one of those, what do they call those things? A pendulum.
Pendulum, yeah.
With a blade comes through and tries to cut him up. And this time he uses some kind of probe beams from his mask to go hit Komodo with these probe beams. And they kind of like put him into a trance. And that's how they capture him. And then you get the backstory of Komodo and how he recognized him. They were like in Korea, and there was a patrol that was out, and they found him, and he just recognized him as a Nazi war criminal. And because he recognized him, he was always out hunting him. Like, he was always on the run from him. That's pretty much how it ended.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, Ted was in the service, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and so
that happened in Korea. I don't know if the Korean War or something. No, this was probably it was probably the Korean War.
Yeah. So
that leads us out of that story and into this one. Was creepy, man. That Madam Evil Eyes is damn ugly.
Yeah, so I'll give this. It's notable that this actually does sort of finally break the formula of how the issue starts. It actually doesn't start with any sort of a trap.
They are searching for a location.
Yeah, yeah.
To do a stunt, and that's they run across something that happens, and it's like, here's where you get all these Kirby demons, and they look weird, man. And this Kirby demon is running and saying, help, help, help. And they're like, why are we need to help him? And then there's all these demonic looking demons that are chasing him, and they don't know why he's being attacked. And they want to investigate it, but this strange dude launches this capsule in the air and knocks both Mr. Miracle and Oberon out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's the two of them. They were scouting for location, and the strange fellow that follows up behind the initial rush through that throws the capsule says the hosts of Satan are everywhere. Beware of meddling with the mystic powers. But when they so they're knocked out, like you said, and when they come to. Oberon was knocked out, and you know, his word balloon when he's waking up is all wavy because he's still kind of out of it. And he asked Mr. Miracle if he was all right, and Mr. Miracle just says, "I was never affected by it. I just hit the ground fast, and then I've been faking them out and watching them leave and waiting for you to wake up." So because he was keeping an eye on them, Mr. Miracle knows where they went, and they end up at this really crazy looking old house. And one of my favorite pages so far is the title page, and it's a splash page, and Mr. Miracle is helping Oberon over a fence and says, "Welcome to Satan's Lair, Oberon." And Oberon says, "Thanks a lot."
And when you get into this, it's like it really does look like a creepy looking Victorian house, right? And mm-hmm. they come up to the door, and you meet this woman, and her eyes, she's just got these creepy ass eyes, this old dress, this old purple dress, this ugly hairdo. She's old, very, very ugly. And then she's around all these demons with masks on them.
I mean, I thought she was a dude at first, and her eyes are like bugged out.
Yeah, she has no eye. She has like no eyelids.
Yeah,
she can't blink. It's like she's just up. And and you think, are these people really related to Satan? Because there's a lot of talk about Satan and her evil eyes and giving their souls to Satan and stuff. So the guy that launched the capsule at him and knocked him out earlier opens the door and allows him in, and that's when Madam Evil Eyes blasts Mr. Miracle with her evil eyes. Look out, her eyes! They boom, and then he gets blasted. And you have a short scene with Lashina and Stompa. I kind of like it. They're looking for a new site and to set up a trap. And Big Barda's saying they're probably looking for a better spot because this spot isn't very good. It has stumps all over the place. And Lashina's using the lash to try to pull the stump up. And Stompa's like, you know, fuck this. She just uses her foot and stomps the stump right into the ground so it's nice and flat. And then they get into it because, you know, they were boasting. And Big Barda has to separate them.
Yeah, Lashina doesn't like Stompa showing her up.
And she did, too.
Mm-hmm. A couple things I thought were funny was when we first see Evil Eyes, I love how one of the demon people behind her says, "The Satan Club shall never die." I just thought that was kind of amusing phrasing, like the Satan Club, like, you know, after school, you know, everyone, you gotta like extracurricular activities. It's like, you know, should I join soccer? Should I join chess club? Or should I join
Satan Club?
But, and then when she blasts Mr. Miracle with her evil eyes, I love that the sound effect is spong. It's a weird sound effect there, but.
And he draws her like with sagging flesh, like she is old.
She's almost like her bugged out eyes, because of them throughout the issue at times, she almost looks just like a cartoon, out of place cartoon character.
Yeah,
you know, not in a bad way, but it's kind of funny how crazy she looks at times, just out of control.
So the next thing is they release Satan, who looks like this concrete gray gargoyle, kind of like from Marvel, except it's not gray, and he grabs Mr. Miracle and breathes fire on him, but he escapes, and the evil eye says, "He's gone! He's nothing but vapor!" And then he's in the background punching one of those demons in the head and knocking him out and freeing Oberon, and they fall in through a trap floor, and he's like, roll with it because it's going to hurt, but you'll survive. And they find that demon, pull off his mask, and it's none other than Ears Watson. He's a monster.
Yeah, so the demon that was getting chased in the beginning, that was real freaky looking, yeah, it turns out to be it's Oberon that recognized him from wanted posters, that he's a top hood. But, so yeah, this issue is broken up into chapters, like a lot of like Silver and Bronze Age comics were. And chapter 3, Devil's Alley, starts out with, as soon as, you know, Ears Watson is unmasked, a panel in the wall opens up, and an arm comes out with a futuristic gun and takes out Ears Watson. So he can't talk, I guess. But actually, you know,
I thought they killed him initially, but it just paralyzes him.
Yeah, it does seem that way. And Mr. Miracle catches the hand that came through the hole long enough for it to drop its weapon. So Mr. Miracle is able to examine it and see that, strangely enough for a bunch of Satan worshippers, they have like futuristic technology, and it's a top secret freeze gun meant to paralyze its target. So, Watson's not dead, but he's as stiff as a statue. And then the wall opens, and creepily, Evil Eye's head is floating in the distance. And again, she fires at him. Spong! Interesting sound effect for those evil eyes of hers.
Yeah.
And then she takes a picture of herself and posts it to Twitter at Daryl Taylor. I guess it's Friday.
The stank guy.
And, yeah. But then after that...
That's a good idea. I think I'm going to take a picture of her and say, look at this stank guy, Daryl.
Yeah. It's like the ultimate... Like, she's the ultimate queen of stank eyes.
Yeah.
She's got a permanent stank eye. It's like she made this stank eye when she was a child and didn't listen to her parents, and then she got stuck that way.
I need to do that. I'm going to take a picture of that. One scene where her eyes are just there and she says, "He was taken back here to me, punished by me, Madam Evil Eyes," and it just has her eyes like there. I'm going to say, "Stank eye."
You could Photoshop Daryl in the background frozen like a statue. But, yeah, so it turns out to be an illusion using mirrors. The traps continue. Mr. Miracle and Oberon are trying to escape, and they have to dodge some flying spears. And, you know, Oberon, his reflexes aren't as quick, so Mr. Miracle just tells him, listen, like, if you just do what I tell you, as soon as I tell you without thinking about it, I'll keep you safe. So, as they're running forward, some bars start coming down, like, as a gate. And so, you know, he tells them to roll, and Oberon rolls. You know, he almost doesn't make it, but he does make it just in time because he, you know, rolls as soon as he's told. And, you know, at this point, Mr. Miracle is getting sick of having to go through all this shit. So he puts his hands on either wall, to either side of him, and generates enough electrical power that he sends the voltage throughout the house. And it creates some feedback through the machinery that the... you know, the minions of Evil Eye are trying to use to, you know, spring the next trap, which apparently was to be dumping some burning oil on them. But yeah, the electricity starts to fry everything and starts a fire in the room that they're in, so Evil Eye has to start to make a run for it.
And she does, and she goes into this door. Well, she runs into this door with still curtains, and she pulls back on it, and Mr. Miracle and Oberon are waiting there, and it's kind of like the Scooby-Doo scene at the end of every Scooby-Doo scene. They're like, we realized what you were doing. You've been using these hoods to steal all this government technology, this top secret technology, and we were going to turn you in. And then Oberon touches a panel on the wall, is like, and here's your loot that you had, and there's all the money that they were making selling all these government secrets. But her powers, she really is, you know, being that she's a hood and she's boss of all these hoodlums, she does have mutant powers. Her eyes are for real. And she sends these, like, her eyes turn to, like, glowing flame balls, and all this material starts hitting them. And Mr. Miracle uses her powers against her. His mask is able to absorb her powers and then fire back at her and do like a backfire and knock her out. And then they want to just turn her and the hoods over to the authorities. And then they're back to business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I will say that between this and reading Tomb of Dracula and just like other stuff from the 70s, it makes it, you know, makes it kind of obvious to me that Satan just doesn't get enough attention in modern comic books.
Yeah.
You know,
that could be for a reason. The 70s, after that comics code lightened up, man, they really cut loose with Satan. I mean, you even had Son of Satan come out, you know, mm-hmm. Hellstorm. and all those other characters, Ghost Rider, all the hell spawn all over, hell this, hell that. It was a pretty creepy time.
So, I mean, it's like, even though comics, there's a lot of violence and sex and stuff like that, there's not a lot of Satan. And I think the Satan Club needs to step it up and, you know, start advocating for their Dark Lord.
Yeah, they need to go hang out with the Mantra Coven.
Yeah.
And after school.
Here on the Retrocast, in between, you know, in between the rumble strips, we bring it back to the Dark Lord.
So, what are you enjoying more, the Tomb of Dracula stuff or the Camelot 3000? Personally.
I feel like I'd have to read a few more issues of Tomb of Dracula to say for sure, but if they're as good as issue 23 especially was, I think that would have the edge for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a huge discrepancy between the two, but I really like 70s style, like horror aesthetic, like, you know, even in movies and stuff like that. So I'm discovering that I really would like to read more of this Bronze Age Marvel stuff, because I'm finding that I enjoy it. I think the Tomb of Dracula is something that I would go into kind of expecting myself to like. Whereas Camelot 3000, on its surface, sounds like it shouldn't work, and it's just way better than I would. Maybe, I don't know if I would say expect it to be because of the creators involved, but just on paper, the concept is something that's just like a little bit wacky.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like how, like, Marvel, especially when, like, with Marv Wolfen and stuff, they, like, I saw this when I read some of the, like, Masters of Kung Fu from, like, towards the end of the Bronze Age, or, you know, at least towards the end of the 70s, like, early 80s, that they were able to take these, like, common concepts or, like, mix in public domain with original characters, and they were able to create these, like, this, through using, like, support casts and original characters, they were able to create like interesting continuity around characters that, you know, it's like, what are you going to do that's different with Dracula? Well, you know, they create these supporting casts and they build up this continuity that makes it kind of like a 70s, like, you know, 70s action film, or like a, you know, like Masters of Kung Fu has a real like old Kung, obviously, Kung Fu action film kind of feel to it, and it feels very 70s, but in like in a good way.
Right.
It has that 70s aesthetic to it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, that wraps up this week, and I guess we have three more issues of Mr. Miracle next week, or is there not quite enough?
I think there's enough. Let's see. I got it here right in front of me. Table of contents reveals that there are...
Oh, yeah, we'll have more than enough.
So we read 12, 13, 14, so next time will be 15, 16, 17.
Shiloh Norman in the next one, who actually became Mr. Miracle later on.
Oh.
Should be interesting.
Carry us along. Yeah, so we'll have one more time of Mr. Miracle, or only Mr. Miracle, and then we'll be getting into some of the return of the fourth world, the return of Kirby to DC.
And I wonder what other tangent I'll go off on in next week. You know, yeah. It's Ultraverse. I don't know what's going to happen.
Between, yeah, how little will you care about Ultraverse 2 weeks from now? And It's easy to do. There's so much out there, but
yeah, I get distracted. I find something else. It's crazy.
But we're almost.
I am gonna finish those runes, though. My shipment's been prepared and should arrive soon. So I will finish that darkness, and I really want to finish because I have no clue where they're gonna go with the volume two, with being that there's only two more issues left.
Yeah.
I have no idea how they're going to wrap that up, if they're even going to wrap it up, or if it's just going to end, you know?
Right.
It's just much has happened and it's all over the place. I don't know how two more issues are going to do anything. I don't even know if the medieval stuff will continue, or because right now he's in the negative zone still freaking out. I don't understand. And then we still got the Warlock storyline. They haven't even met yet. I don't know where that's going. But it's weird how it ties so much into Marvel continuity, because it had those little editor, you know, splotches. And it referenced, like, all these different Warlock series throughout time, including the Infinity Gauntlet. So it was really weird.
Yeah, I mean, just so despite what I thought, I mean, they did. It does sound like they made some effort to tie it in. So that's interesting. Yeah, we're zeroing at the end of this month. I mean, we're almost. Our first episode of the Retrocast was released at the end of October of last year, so we're almost up to our 1 year anniversary.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, it's gone by fast.
And I think next time we said once we finish the Kirby, we're gonna take a little bit of a break from Kirby and visit something else. I don't know what that's gonna be yet.
Yeah, we'll have to decide that, but yeah, I think it's a good idea to change things up. Even though everyone in the world loves Kirby.
Yeah.
There's no one out there that doesn't want to hear about Kirby 60s stuff.
That's awesome.
Even though it's not from the 60s, it's from the
70s.
Keith Knutson.
All right. So this has been Retrocast. I am Mike and Chris, and we can be found at geekbrunchpodcast.com. And then you can also find us on Facebook under Geek Brunch Podcast and clicking the like button. And we're on Forum for Geeks. Scroll down to Geek Brunch and we post episode threads there. And last but not least, Twitters at MythMakingETC and at Mike Myers Brunch.
And you can also PayPal us money at mythmakingetc@gmail.com and mike@comicbooknoise.com.
And we will buy more comics.
Yeah, don't bother like writing us or anything. Just send money.
Yeah. Leave an iTunes review. That's like money for us.
Yeah, that would be nice.
So
you can go to it's the same feed, regular Geek Brunch. You can just mention in the review that you're referring to the Retrocast.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, you have a good week. I'm back to work next week. I took a week off. I didn't get as much done as I wanted.
That's always the way.
I just had a room full of the impossible to deal with, and I don't know, man. I just don't have enough. I'm running out of physical space. I have nowhere to grow.
Build an annex.
Yeah.
Or you'll have to start storing comics at like your fellow podcasters' houses.
Yeah, ship them over there.
Be like, you know, it's like, here's the Mike Myers comic book collection annex number one.
Why are all these comic books by the bed? First it's the scene with the lights, and now you have all these comic book boxes by the bed. What is going on with you, Chris?
Let's see this. It's like, well, I am the holder for for the Eclipse comic part of Mike Myers' collection. And so that's my responsibility to curate that part of his holdings.
Yeah, all my because I start storing at your house, Daryl's house, Keith's house.
That's like your Vertigo books. You have to go to Virginia to find your Vertigo books, and then
see under Daryl.
Yeah, it's filed in different places.
Continuity like, books with Chris. All right. Well, you have a good one.
I can't believe
the bills lost, man. Shit.
I'm like, it's just. Buffalo supports is just, I don't, you know, it's just depressing.
I don't know. I thought they had that game, you know.
Well, I guess they haven't had any blowouts, right? I
mean, no, they're in everything for the most part. Hmm. And they seem like they're pretty. They seem like a, what would you say, like a 50-50 team? Like they have potential to get to the playoffs if things line up right. But Dolphins and Patriots are still winning, you know, over and over again.
Yeah, I'm expecting that if whenever Tom Brady announces retirement, that there's going to be like a citywide party for like maybe like a month straight in Buffalo. This is just like going to cancel work throughout the city, and it's just going to be like you're going to think that the Bills won the Super Bowl, and all it will just be that Tom Brady retired. But yeah, I mean, I think they seem like a genuine football team. Like there were times during like the Dick Duran era that you wondered even if they should be playing in the NFL.
Yeah.
And their quarterback, I mean, he seems like he has like the presence of mind and like the strength of character to be a quarterback. I think that's one of the most difficult positions in sports.
Yeah. Well, you have to know so much. You have to know.
Yeah.
You don't just have to know your position. You have to know everybody else's position and where they're going to be.
Right. And you got to be able to think quickly on your feet. You can't be phased. You can't be intimidated, you know?
Yeah.
And it seems like he has some of that quality there, but I don't know. And this hockey just started, and the Sabres have lost their first three games, so that just, you know, further depresses people around here. Underdog city, man. It's like, if you like rooting for the underdog, you move here.
You move there and start rooting.
So.
All right. Well, I'm going to go take Harley for a walk, her long-awaited walk. She gets impatient.
Yeah. I know what that's like.
And then I'm going to try to help clean that upper room, or at least get it to a point where I can move around.
You can go to work and feel like you made some progress.
Yeah, I want to read more, though. God, I've been filing so much old stuff, is what I want to do is sit down and read.
Yeah, I always get off this podcast thinking, oh, man, comic books. I need to read some more old stuff.
Yeah, I found some new universe stuff I want to try. I mean, there's a couple stuff I found that... Plus, I want to read those Treasury Edition books. There's so much I want to read, and just not enough time.
Yeah.
And I got to get this living room back to... I had it clean, like I had filed and moved, but then I moved stuff from upstairs back into the living room, and now it's back to where it was. So Barb's like, you didn't do shit.
And you gotta keep her happy, because then you think you're running out of room now, you really have nowhere to put comic books if you make her mad.
Nowhere to put myself.
Yeah. You'll just be like, again, we'll reference Steve Martin and the Jerk.
Yeah.
It's like, fine, I'm leaving. All I need is these
700 long boxes.
all I need are DC comics from the Bronze Age and this in Marvel comics from the Bronze Age
and some Rune from Malibu
all I need is, you know,
Tomb of Dracula Omnibus.
All I need are these Avatar books and. Like, who's that guy? Who's that guy leading that chain of 15 shopping carts down the street? And they're all packed.
They're all packed with comic boxes.
It's like, is that all of his food or something? Looks like comic books.
Who's shooting these cans? All right. Well, I'll talk to you later, Chris. Have a good week.
All right, you too. Take care. Bye bye.
As the snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto, and his mama cries. Cause if there's one thing that she don't need is another hungry mouth to feed her.